This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and support the network at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 212, Erin Gray's Blue Jumpsuit. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. First, we'll be talking about the Star Trek Discovery trailer released at CBS Upfronts, including characters, visuals, and those new Klingons. Then in the feature, we're joined by Bruce Gibson and Kay Elizabeth Shaw to discuss the Voyager episode, Workforce. So let's step into The Ready Room. Well, Larry, fancy meeting you here on this dusty desert planet for the screening of the Star Trek Discovery trailer.
Speak for yourself, Chris. I came to see the King of Jordan because I heard he's a big Star Trek fan.
And that is where they filmed that planet that we see at the beginning of the trailer, was on location in Jordan.
And it was a pretty well-held secret, too, there. They kept it pretty well to the vest.
So the last show we did, you and I talked all about Discovery. That was before the trailer, before we knew any real details like we do now. The trailer dropped at Upfronts for CBS, and now we have all kinds of things that we can talk about. The internet is buzzing. Fans are kicking and screaming. Some people are excited. Some people are loving it. Some people are really upset about it. As you would expect, it's quite a mix. So we're going to talk about it together today and just share our thoughts on it. And before we get into the list, we've bullet pointed a number of items here: visuals, characters, Klingons, story, fan reaction, and our expectations. Just first thoughts, Larry, watching it, what did you think?
It was very cinematic. Going to the landscape of streaming, just kind of knowing what CBS would be after, knowing what Brian would have wanted to do and what they've picked up the mantle, that epic feel. It's great to see. I mean, I did a comparison when we know that the Next Generation episodes at first were 1.5 million, which seemed like a ton compared to the 60s shows. They were always talking about being chronically underfunded and having budgets cut. Even with inflation, that was really a step up. And I did the figuring here. We had estimates of 6-7 million an episode, which is kind of the model now for, you know, streaming for a short season, these big ticket, big look, luxurious shows. That's, even with inflation, that's about twice what they were spending per episode when the Next Generation started, even toward the end of the run with inflation and Enterprise of that TV era. So the look, the bucks are on the screen and it looks gorgeous, and you have that feel, you have that expansive look. So that all registered with me. It was good to see some of the details. People, obviously, like we said, the fan reaction online, people have been micromanaging that, or, you know, microanalyzing that for ages, and just hungry for detail. So, bang, the upfronts happen. We can talk about all this later. But my gut reaction is great. There are details. In fact, there's one fun little detail I'll mention in a minute that I've seen no one manage to talk about yet that struck me on second look. But all kinds of choices, as with anything, things I would have done differently. But then the other thing is, and I've heard this through the wind, that even, you know, what we're seeing here on this trailer is not even meant to be an all points answer to everything. They're still going to be holding back teasers and spoilers. So I would still, I'm not saying this out of any big abundance of knowledge, I would still say all this Sturm und Drang about microanalyzing the trailer, it's obviously film that's been shot. But as far as big picture conclusions we can draw, this has all been put together for a reason, for a certain way, to get people hungry.
Yeah.
It's put together to sell ads and get good ad rates.
Exactly.
Was the first.
That's a big thing.
Right, yeah. Right. So they want to show that they've spent a lot of money and filmed in Jordan and and done all this and mm-hmm. spent it wisely, which it looks like. We still have a lot of time left to microanalyze all of this. But that won't stop the rest of the internet. They're all busy at it already.
Exactly. You mentioned TNG budget in the beginning, $1.5 million per episode. So doing the calculation in dollars today, that would be about $3 million, I believe.
Yeah, $3.25 million. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the budget for Discovery, as I understand it, is $6 to $7 million
per episode.
So it's double the budget of TNG. But if you look at what they're doing, of course, because technology has mm-hmm. advanced so much and it's so much easier to make things look very polished compared with 1987, they're able to do that with just double the money. But it does have a good budget. One point there, Larry, that you made was that this trailer was made for a specific reason. I've heard a number of people say that this doesn't look like Star Trek to me. It doesn't feel like Star Trek to me. And I'm sort of echoing what I said back when the first Beyond trailer
came out. That's exactly what I was going to say, yes.
As diehard Star Trek fans, we do have to remember that this trailer for Upfront, this 2.5-minute piece, it was not made for us. It wasn't made to satisfy the desires of every longtime Star Trek fan. It was made to introduce an upcoming TV show to the industry to give ad executives something to use to sell advertising. And that's the first purpose of it. And then the second purpose is to show us Star Trek fans what's coming up so that we can get excited about it. So just keep that in mind when you see something that you feel is maybe too much action or they're showing too much of this or that and it doesn't feel like Star Trek. Again, it's being made for a specific industry purpose.
Right. The sequence at the beginning that was busy showing how much epic feel it was going to contain with all that location shooting in the middle of the desert in Jordan, that was also a fairly contemplative scene. It's almost like people can only process one aspect at a time. So they see the space battle scenes and think it's all action. But that was a very Star Trek Beyond trailer, Kirk Bones in the bar moment there when you had Captain Georgiou and Burnham there, the two characters being quietly conversational. Like, don't forget that aspect of the whole scene, too. That was a nice, quiet character moment going on there, even though we were busy. It was the first thing on the trailer, so we're all busy, you know, soaking up all we can about it. Yeah, this is exactly. The Beyond trailer was made for a Star Wars audience to run before Star Wars, whichever one it was at the time. But I do there's obviously a level that went into this for the outside world. We can get into this later, but I think it's kind of comical. So I was watching. There was no live feed. You know, the upfronts are the weekly. I've even reading news stories for the analysts that are trade. They're totally, you know, television media reporters and analysts mm-hmm. talking about whether the upfronts are an anachronism now. That in the era of so much beyond broadcast, you know, the upfronts are where each day the major four networks and the other little ones fit in around it. But basically it's like NBC and ABC and Fox, and then CBS went last this time on Thursday. They do all their big special, and they even do production numbers. And CBS apparently is the big splashiest with Stephen Colbert and a dance number and this whole thing. It was like the opening to the Oscars or something.
Right.
And it's just for that audience, and they count out to them, and they, you know, kiss up to them and all that. But the base thing is, here's how cool our shows are, and here's how much we want to charge for ads per minute. So, right? And then they dicker mm-hmm. over it. And so they're putting their best foot forward. That was the main thing. This is all access. And so there was a little bit of confusion going in about how that would get presented. And for the first time, CBS Interactive, which technically has all access in it, was doing that. And there was a little bit of a hoo-ha about Interactive doing this. But if you went to a lot of the CBS.com or some of the even media, I was trying to live blog it, watch the live blog on Deadline.com. There was no mention. It's mm-hmm. like Discovery was off the radar because it wasn't a tokenly CBS show, and mm-hmm. which was so there was a little bit of that going on. But it's like, guys, this is really about their primetime shows. We're all deathly interested in it because it's Star Trek, and there is a niche to serve for that. But as far as like serving the outer public beyond what was in that room, it wasn't geared for us, even though there were ways to access it. And there was plenty of genre media there who were live blogging it and live tweeting. There was live tweeting going on. So that's, you know, I know that internally in CBS, there was a live feed that the employees could watch. Otherwise, it wasn't like a major news event that we were all getting to watch somewhere. It wasn't set up for that.
Well, and also, Larry, outside of the U.S., everyone knows that the show is being distributed on Netflix. And Netflix has its own trailer, which is 90 seconds. It's a very watered-down version of this 2.5-minute trailer that was shown at Upfronts. And in that, and on Netflix, Star Trek Discovery is billed... Well, if you look at the trailer for Upfronts, down in the bottom right corner, it has a CBS All Access original series. Well, outside of the U.S. on Netflix, it says a Netflix original series, Star Trek Discovery. There's no mention of CBS. It's completely branded as a Netflix original series. That's something that I think people in the U.S. might not realize, since you don't get to see the Netflix angle
right
on TV there.
Well, of course, it's very controversial. So many people are angry, and this is nothing new. This is from day one. People have been upset that this is going to be a streaming service they have to pay for. They don't get why CBS... I mean, I understand why CBS feels like they want to do that. This whole dynamic, I mean, I guess, I don't know. I've been around the block once or twice. Everybody is focusing on the trailer, as they should, but there's all kinds of... Just as there was the initial... Remember the very first press announcement of this was, hi, we're doing a Star Trek. We don't know what the name, we don't know what the format, the content is, but what we do know is we're doing this because we need to do our own streaming service. It was just like, it was the UPN, you know, 20 years later. And what's in our corporate family? What's the smartest thing to lead with? Well, Star Trek, of course. And someone must have thought there's still a perception that Star Trek, even on their Showtime, you know, equivalent to HBO, that it wouldn't work there, but somehow it's going to, or maybe it would, but they need it out here to be the lead, to be the flagship for this new business they're doing. Everything else, who's going to do it, who's going to run it, what it's going to be about, what's even the format, Prime or Kelvin, that was all later. The main thing was, we've got one name attached and we're doing it. And, you know, that kind of boggled people at first. It was like, well, that tells you what it is and how it's going to develop. Now, to their credit, as we've talked about before, all the iterations and all the way this is rolled out and the hiccups and delays and what the between the lines of all of that has been. But the bottom line is that nobody jerked the carpet and said, nope, you said January, deliver on January or May, you know, no more. They are now giving this answer that annoys so many fans. But when they say we will do it when it's ready, that's really the best thing you could be saying, right? That's really the best corporate parentage that they could be giving it. They're giving it time to breathe and do. And then the huge news that I hope didn't get past everybody when they announced it at the front was they've added two more episodes to The Order.
Yeah, that's been reported pretty widely.
Right. But I mean, I think that went past a lot of, I mean, it's there, but it's like, let that sink in. What does that mean? It means they're thrilled with it. And they think that the money, either that or just the fact that the money they're spending, they want to amortize it further and get a little more out of it. So some bookkeeper has done some bean counters, done the math again, and figured out, hey, we can make two more episodes and spend that money more wisely.
But it probably means that they're happy with what's being
done. Yeah, the bottom
line,
yes.
The story needs two more episodes to breathe.
Right.
That's good.
Right. But it's all positive.
You mentioned that in the beginning, one question might be, is it going to be Kelvin or is it going to be Prime Timeline? And of course, we know it's Prime Timeline. However, getting into some points about the trailer itself, one of the first comments that I've heard from people is about the visuals and that it feels too much like it's the Kelvin timeline. And I don't disagree. It does feel like that. My question, I guess, would be, is it just that look and feel is science fiction movie making, science fiction television making in 2017? And could the traditional Star Trek visuals even work in 2017?
Well, that's exactly it. But okay, define traditional Star Trek. I mean, does no one remember? Because no one sit down and look at Netflix and look at original series versus even next gen versus even getting down to forget the movies. Look at original series, next gen, and then the end of that arc by the time of Enterprise. Look how much slicker, can I say that? Look how much,
exactly.
How more modern Enterprise looked. And it's on the budget that we're talking about. They were making all kinds of CG adaptations. They were shooting it digitally. by the end of the run then.
Yeah.
So I don't know what this token, well, I mean, again, everybody thinks back to the last iteration when they project forward. Yes, this is what if you're going to compete, and I know CBS really wants the franchise to stack up against Star Wars and Marvel and DC and Harry Potter and Doctor Who and Game of Thrones and all of the other TV level iterations. They want it on that level, and it's got to look that way to sell. It's got to look that way to compete around the world to play, because the entire world is not a Star Trek fan pre-sold. And it's got to be on that level, which is good for us. It's good for fans for it to be that good a production look to it. But it's going to be of our world, but that's nothing new. Every 20 years goes by, and of course, the technology and the way things are done. It's great that they're not going cheap on it. I don't understand.
Yeah. Well, so that's my point. I mean, you made the point that I feel, which is that if you're going to make science fiction today, whether it's Star Trek or whatever it is, it's kind of going to look like this. I mean, you can go back to the Battlestar Galactica reboot where you see this aesthetic starting to come into play, and then it evolved into what we now know as the Kelvin timeline in Star Trek. You know, there's a moment in the trailer where they fire the torpedoes and it goes by really quickly, but it feels more like the Battlestar Galactica style of the torpedo flying out, and you've got like the smoke trail going behind it. It's just the sort of more real feeling,
more
as opposed to a laser.
Right.
Visceral, yeah. And I could be wrong about that because, again, I can't see very well right now, and B, I watched this, it goes by very quickly.
But you
quickly.
Could see it at all, Chris, and we're thankful for that.
Yes, that's right. But what you're saying about the bookends is true as well, that between the original series and the Next Generation, you had this long, long gap. And so obviously the visual aesthetics and the style of filmmaking changed. And likewise, between the end of Voyager and Enterprise, it's a much shorter gap, but the technology, and because they were changing time periods in the storytelling, they felt like, okay, well, we can make this change. And you see a bit of evolution there. And that makes sense, too. When I say traditional Star Trek visuals, what I think most fans feel is the traditional Star Trek visual style is second half of the Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, where everything kind of settled in and it has this uniform feel across the board, with the exception of Deep Space Nine, where you have the Cardassian station and much more texture in the lighting and such. But it's that Starfleet feeling. I just think that a lot of fans, they want a continuation of that because it gives them more of that Star Trek that they loved for so many decades. And that's why it's hard for them to swallow this drastic change in the visual style, even though I agree, and I think most people, if they really think about it from the business standpoint, would agree that for Star Trek to compete with other properties in 2017, to connect with an audience that's not the diehard Star Trek fans that we are, it does kind of have to look like this because that's where the expectations are.
Right. Well, okay, look at this. Most of the scenes we saw aboard ship were in the middle of crisis leading up to that, whatever. Mm-hmm. So we don't even know what standard lighting is. I mean, there's so many, you know, we talk about canon, we talk about all kinds of things. There's even like a production canon, which is what you've been talking about, the way the thing is shot and lit, edited, you know, all of that, framed. There's written canon, which is to me is like the format. And part of that would be like, how is it structured? There are commercials, so we'll still have acts. So is it going to be a four act? Is it going to be five act? Is it a regular traditional Star Trek teaser credits and four or five acts, you know, with a tag scene at the end? Or it's not going to be commercialless streaming, so we won't have that, even though commercialless is an option now, apparently. Thank God. But there's production, appearance, protocol, style book. But then as far as canon itself goes, we've got conceptual canon. Like, if it's going to be prime, what does that really mean? And then visual canon. And a lot of times people lump those together where one might be very strong. I was always worried about the format canon being great, but maybe the visual, because you're subject to creators and designers and what that is. And I'm not so much worried about the style of modern TV. We've already leaped from the 60s to the 80s and then to the aughts, evolved into that. That's going to be that way. And again, we've only seen snippets, and probably these are all from the pilot. So different shows will have different tones. Hopefully there'll be some shows that are more stable as far as the situation at hand in the drama. So it doesn't have to be tilt camera and underlit and black lighting and all that. But, you know, I still have quiggles about, details, and not to be, hey, you kids, get off my cannon lawn, get off my AstroTurf. But I still have, you know, concerns about that or wondering how we'll blend it in. But the overwhelming weight of this, the money is here. This is happening. Every major turn in Star Trek history has been an adjustment to get used to it. Even going into motion picture, when all people had done for 10 years was pray to their savior Gene to get a show back, to get it back. And even with all the changes and even the canon explanation for the changes, it was still a big change. TV, 60s cheap TV to cinematics, Robert Wise, much less the pastel pajamas and the all chrome, dull chrome backgrounds and all of that. And then another turn, you know, I just remember it wasn't so much about Savick crying as people yelling Admiral on the bridge. That was so militaristic to me. That was such a shock in the face back at the time. Now I go, okay, fine. And then it's like even there's once or twice when Riker leans in his pajamas and says Admiral on the bridge on Next Generation a couple of times. So it's amazing what we assimilate and get used to. And as long as the stories hold up and all that, I mean, my little retcon canon, you know, gap filler, canon fixer, mine will be going over time. Although I keep seeing things where people I trust, people I see tweeting, say, guys, even these things you're worrying about, like in the visuals, there will be answers. So I'm trying not to be the people on the other side of me in 87 when I said, will you all just shut up? We have new Star Trek back on TV. What is wrong with you? Be quiet, sit down, and let's watch. And, you know, I'm trying not to be that guy, and it's fairly easy.
Well, let's talk about another thing from the trailer. We learned a bit about the characters, just a little bit, but it seems that Burnham, who is the main character, has served under Captain Georgiou for 7 years at the start of the story.
A good Star Trek number.
They seem to be...
seven.
Exactly. And I would assume that that means, although it may not mean, that she has served under Georgiou as a crew member of the Shenzhou. But we also find out that she apparently, well, I say apparently, I don't know for sure, grew up on Vulcan. You know, maybe she was just on Vulcan as a little kid and she moves away. But the fact that Sarek continues to communicate with her so much as an adult, and they present her like she is some sort of bridge between cultures and she's going to bring everyone together. And she even says, I'm trying to save all of you. And there's this one moment where I have to watch the trailer again to make sure, but I think Sarek says something to her on the holo communicator, which they brought that back from Deep Space Nine, but the holo communicator. And she tilts her head in a very, very Vulcan way, which is why I feel like maybe she actually grew up on Vulcan. Maybe she's half Vulcan. You can't tell. I kept pausing it, looking at her ears and trying to see if there was anything there. But there's definitely...
You and 47 million others, big, Chris. That's what... Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely some big background to the story of Commander Burnham and Vulcan and Sarek. And I don't know. Well, we find out that she is Sarek's daughter. Who knows?
Sarek's daughter or a charge or something or whatever. What, you know, he's wound up with her. It was enough to cram Cybok in there, Chris. Come on, let's try not to get too carried away. But some connection. It's always intrigued me that Brian at the very beginning talked about how he loved Amanda as a character right out of the gate. I think the day of I was there live at the Comic-Con big preview where they showed the first trailers. And then when the casting came down, nothing much more was said about that. And I thought, oh, she'll be in a show. And then they wound up announcing the actor playing, and it'd be Sarek. I'm like, I wonder if this is a transmogrification of his initial arc. But, you know, I know. So, yeah, we'll see that. And then people upset about the holoprojector. I'm like, well, was that a holoprojector? Was that a Vulcan thing that wasn't shared with the, you know. Here's it brought back to me, as we get all upset about some of these things, or as I'm already spinning my head about how to smooth canon smoothing over, although there's some uber fans on the staff, I'm already thinking about, you know, there is this fact that we now know that there was first contact with the Vulcans, 60 years from now, 2063, whatever. And then it takes 2063, 21, 22. It's 200 years before we find out about Vulcans and Ponfar. Although, there, you know, now we know about T'Pol and Archer. It's like, there are these ridiculous gaps of secrecy and people not talking to each other in Star Trek of the major cultures. The other one that always gets me is we've known about Trills since Emini and Emini and McCoy were dating, and they've been a thing. Even if they weren't Federation members, they were a thing. And it has to pop. It's like, boy, all the big stories always break on Enterprise. Whatever your Enterprise ship is when, oh, look, it's major Federation intercultural history made once again. It's a breakthrough. It's how can you, like, these cultures that stonewall these secrets for two centuries, three. I don't know. We didn't think we knew you well enough yet. Have we dated long enough for me to tell you about Ponfar? Have I dated you long enough to tell you about symbiosis? I don't know. Have I dated you long to tell you about our symbiosis scandal? I'm still waiting for somebody to do a story about the fact that they're not really having to make that. They just, you know, would have a riot if everybody could. So anyway, so given the things like that, it's like, you know, guys, there's still a door. There's still a fairly large crack in the door here that you can sneak some major crazy thing. So if the Vulcans want to secretly have long distance holoprojection technology 100 years before DS9, I well, let's see. Maybe that's a storytelling device. Maybe that's like looking up and seeing Delta Vega from, or seeing Vulcan from the surface of Delta Vega.
Right, right.
It's a metaphysical moment.
See. Okay, I didn't mean to take us on a big tangent about the holo projection community.
Sorry, but I mean, I will back off of a detail. I have one of the details I want to bring out. But that's a thing that whole bit about, you know, guys, there are still some crazy wacky doodle unexplained secrets in Star Trek. I mean, we know that it's a wide open secret, but how did that become a secret not a known thing for 200 years among friends? So.
Right.
Keep that in your back pocket.
All right. So, other things involving characters, we don't know anything about it. Just looking at what we see on the screen, there appears to be some kind of android.
Yeah, a lot of things flying by, whether that was eye candy, set dressing. I mean, they were obviously made of actors, but I mean, whether that was, you know, wacky.
Well, he was working the controls. I mean, he's obviously a member of the bridge crew, and this is, of course, long, long before Data.
Right. Well, and the other bit with
android like
that. Yeah, well, assume type android's pretty advanced, but, you know, robotics. Well, I know. Again, think of the state of androids and robotics in Kirk's time. So, and the prejudices and the cultural. Yeah. We'll see.
Then again, that could have been a humanoid with some really, really interesting tattoos on the sides of his head. So,
yes, that could have just been an alien affectation of a race. But, you know, again, we find, you know, there's, now Brian said this was not about Section 31, so I don't mean that literally. And I don't know. I hope that hasn't evolved, or if it has, I guess I don't care. As long as there's some kind of explanation. But, you know, you think about Next Generation showing how we've retconned it to be Section 31. But Admiral Pressman and the phasing cloak, you know, where we didn't have cloaking devices, and oh, here's a secret project to do that. I mean, the whole, you were talking about cinematography and the grittiness of this versus the well-lit shows. And we said it from day one. I said, if Brian is running this, this is going to be an atypical show. And it's going to be, it wasn't going to be a stand-up show. And the fact that it comes out where the lead character is Lieutenant Commander kind of shows you it's a different kind of storytelling. And it's more like, it's just out-of-the-box storytelling that people get into now. Non-linear, flashback, multi, you know, dimensions, whatever. Science fiction or not. It's not straight ahead, standalone, captain, six officers on a bridge on a ship, bang, 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 every mission every week. And that's cool. That kind of an out-of-the-box format means that this darker, I mean, DS9 was supposed to be the out-of-the-box show in its time. So that motif, this all fits together. And the fact that there could be experimentals or black ops or secret, even whether it's Section 31 or not, the fact that there could be a lot of one-offs in this series, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Exceptional devices, add-ons, technologies, people from planets that may not be typical Federation members or participants, or odds and end things, which to me is just like a lot of texture. So, as long as everything is explained, that's great. And there is still this whole thing is supposed to be the same time as The Cage, and we'll work on that when we get to it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's another obstacle that fans have is both visuals and technological level of Starfleet at the time, the fact that it is supposed to be the same time as the Cage mm-hmm. and then leading into the original series. It can be difficult to reconcile. But again, I don't think you should try to reconcile it based on a 2.5 minute trailer. We right. need to actually see the entire story first, and then we can figure out how it fits in or does not fit in. One other character that we can mention from the trailer, last time you and I were talking about Doug Jones's character of Lieutenant Saru.
Right.
And Saru means monkey in Japanese. And I said, well, if he has a tail, you heard it here first. Well, I believe that Lieutenant Saru is the alien that we see in the trailer.
Yeah, definitely.
Who says that his species can sense death and he senses it now. So he is not themed on a primate, apparently. He's some other type of alien. But I've seen some people say, oh, it's so ridiculous. A species that evolved just to sense the coming of death. And that's not really exactly what he says.
No.
He says something like, he's biologically determined to sense the coming of death, which is not the same thing as evolving for that purpose. And again, we don't even know what this means
right.
from this little clip in the trailer. It's kind of dramatic.
Well, it's obviously meant to make a point, the death. And I think somewhere yeah. on some Trek FM, I probably said, and again, he's been actively away from the project for a long time, but he birthed the concept and was heavily into the pilot at least. But the very first interview I did with Brian back when he was a baby writer, the first year of Voyager, and did episodes like Coda and a few others, where I kind of said, gosh, there's this theme running through all of your episodes about death. And he was like, yeah, I have this thing about death. And then you think about all of his series, Pushing Daisies and Wonderfalls and Dead Like Me and mm-hmm. and Hannibal. So it's I when I heard that line, I went, I'm going to bet that was an original route. It may just be the dramatic moment. I can't believe that they would say that kind of a stand, you know, like a big canon line. We were we were genetically manipulated. We were the verb about death. Seems like it serves the moment in the pilot, but something like that. Because mm-hmm. the other thing I had in my head was like, oh, it's, what's he going to say? I sense great death. Here. It's like, oh, it's Troy revisited. It's like, what, they're going to back away from that? And oh, we're going to downplay the death sensing.
And then we find out that yeah. he's actually wearing a cheerleader outfit. And yeah, it was very, very
yeah,
odd.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
I just had this flashback.
And his tail was coming out from the back of the cheerleader outfit. And,
but they did do a big heavy-duty reveal on, I mean, they went all in on showing that. It wasn't one of those quick pans. They were like, here is Saru's head.
Yeah.
So that was one thing they didn't mind, giving up.
And in the Upfronts trailer, that is a pause in the action, and it is this dramatic
yes.
moment. And in the Netflix trailer, they cut those lines together, and it happens really quickly, and he just says, I sense the coming of death, and I sense it now. Just like that. It's so matter of fact, and it's so fast, and it has a completely different feeling from the Upfront trailer of mm-hmm. the same scene. So that just goes to show you how the impression that you get from what you're seeing depends on the editing of the trailer, and it can be completely different using the same material. So again, don't read too much into what you're seeing right now.
Every time you mention the fact that you're watching a Netflix trailer, there's a certain segment of the audience just going all over again.
Well, I would remind people you do have to pay for Netflix as well. It's not a free service. So, of course, I guess many people already have Netflix.
That was right.
Therefore, they wouldn't have to
right.
pay for a second one. Can we talk about the Klingons for a minute?
Nope.
Because this has
we
been
can't.
Probably the biggest area of angst that I see online. So I just have two questions for you. One, why redesign the Klingons? And then the second one, which I think most fans aren't even thinking about, how close are these Klingons to Gene's original description and vision for the Klingons? Because the Klingons as we know them now are a product of the Next Generation, and they came about kind of halfway through the series when they really started bringing the Klingons into the storyline.
Well, really the motion picture.
Well, but the motion picture Klingons, for me anyway, are a little bit closer to these Klingons than the Klingons that we get later in Star Trek.
Well, I basically think of smooth foreheads, which have all been like retconned with the whole augment virus. But the motion picture Klingons, the whole thing was a Klingon spine came up the back of your neck and didn't end at your neck. It came up the back and all the way down your forehead. Right. And it's just been a matter of how elaborate are the forehead ridges as makeup and how, you know. And if, but then, you know, Christopher Plummer demands in Six, demands that he would not do heavy prosthetics. And they get these very little light dots. So at the time, that was annoying. Now we have it as a sign of how much species diversity there is. So all of this angst about the uniforms and the look, the physical look and the garb they're wearing, I have been clinging right now, clinging on to the idea of that species diversity. It's really funny how on one hand we get into these, every alien is a, you know, bumpy headed, you know, humanoid in makeup. And then we get into some of these variations. Now, the real world, it's a dangerous thing. You've got a franchise like Star Trek that on one hand has a canon that I was saying this week, it's like the glue that holds all the other good parts of Star Trek together. You know, people love the theme issues. People love the commentary. People love the futurism. People love the gadgets. People love the casting and the commentary. My five C's of Star Trek. And we love to make, you know, a lot of us live and die by canon. A lot of us even make fun of canonistas. You know, it's the gamut. But that really is, I always want to make sure and do that because it's not just the fact that that's what's held Star Trek together and put it up there with other blockbuster franchises. It was the original blockbuster franchise. And yes, I know, TV franchise. And I know Doctor Who was there before, but it didn't market and go big globally until after Star Trek showed how. Star Trek wrote the book, was the template for everything that we have now in pop culture. And part of that is the reason that it's got a unified canon and universe that people have tried to hold to. Not always did it right, made goofs, but you go back to Gene's and Dorothy's and Bob Justman's memos in the beginning, that was what they had to respect the audience. If they don't believe this world, they won't believe our people are real people having real life adventures and drama. It's all part of the thing. It shouldn't be isolated. But then you have the creative tension of, it's been 50 years, things evolve. It's been amazing that we have had as much continuity as we've had. Even when people mean to be in the same universe, you wind up with, you know, 50 to 100 people working on a production, whether it's a movie or even more so a series. And it's very hard. The whole world does not want to do restoration drama or World War II dramas. I mean, that's a science. When you think science fiction, people want to be creative. Costumers and set designers and makeup people want to be creative. They want to exercise their creative muscles. It takes a really specific producer in charge and then people bringing that to bear across all the guilds and the crafts to say, okay, this thing from 50 years ago, we want to recreate that. Now, if that's the charge, that's fine. But that's a creative tension and dynamic. We saw at the beginning of Enterprise when it was, how do you do modern sets to look like they came before sets built in the 60s? And you kind of do a thing about the original series sets were so powerful, they look simplistic. You know, the conceit they came up with on Trials and Tribulations when it was, we're going to close in on K7 and the Enterprise and a D7. We're going to see a ton more detail on them. And the reason we didn't see it in the 60s was obviously they didn't build the models that detailed. But we're just going to move in closer on things. And that was the conceit. So it's almost like we're moving in closer on the technology. When they built the bridge for darkness, in a mirror darkly, in Enterprise, I thought that original series set held up wonderfully, built to the 2005 standards, because they brought a few more levels of detail as they got closer to it. I thought it looked great. But that dilemma, again, that was the big controversy of Enterprise and their sets and their submarine sets. And the fact that it looked busy, it looked more advanced. Well, busy can be a sign of being more backward as opposed to being sleek. And that's what these, so we've got a whole new crew who have no real lineage. You know, there's nobody working. There are a couple people from earlier iterations working on the show. But in the creative side of things, nobody comes from that lineage. And we talk about the costumes and the uniforms and the comm badges and the rank system and the ships and all of that stuff. sometimes it's supposed to be the Pike era, and some of that, it's hard to restrain that creative urge and have people, unless somebody at the top says, this is not a new, another science fiction show, think of this as historical recreationism. You wouldn't go do a, you know, you wouldn't go do a World War I drama and insist on having TVs because you want to show some visuals on the, to, you know.
Right.
So it's to a lot of people, to us, when we look at this, we think of it as historical recreationism. It's history of the future. As we've seen it already. So it's a dynamic. And again, all we can do is sit back. We can vent and all that, but it's been shot. It's been filmed. I'm not going to sink the whole show based on that. I'm just going to let my mind run ragged, you know, let the gears spin as to how we can take all those nitty gritty, dark, shadowy corner aspects of the story and maybe let that run with it. And no, that we haven't seen all the pieces. We've seen a tiny fraction of all the pieces. And know that I keep seeing public assurances from Uber fans who are connected to the show or the network going, guys, trust us, trust us, trust us. I know some of your concerns, but trust us, trust us, trust us. Or keep watching. You haven't seen it all yet. You haven't seen it all yet. You can't judge from what you've seen.
We've seen almost none of it.
Right, exactly. So I'm saving my, minutes. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, the Klingons, it's one of those things where it feels unnecessary to change them so drastically. Doing it in the Kelvin timeline also seems unnecessary, but at least that's an alternate timeline. In this timeline, it feels like for the sake of storytelling, it might be better to keep them a little bit closer to what we're familiar with.
Let me run far afield. I can't believe it, Chris. But real to your point about Klingons, I somehow get the, you know, for years, people said, gosh, a great Star Trek series or miniseries would be a Klingon series. And I kept thinking, Game of Houses, great Klingon houses. So maybe if there are some elements, if we're going to get into some inter-Klingon drama, maybe we need to see some more, again, some species diversity. And maybe that can, not just the physiology, but the garb and everything, the costume. So,
well, it could be that these Klingons, they live on Kronos. They look a bit different. You know,
right.
It doesn't mean these are the only Klingons. And we won't know that until we see the whole story.
Right.
So,
right.
Again, another reason to calm down a little bit. We'll see what they're doing. Well, one more thing, and then we'll wrap up our news segment. Because believe it or not, Larry, we've been talking about the trailer for over 40 minutes now.
Oops.
Time flies when you have a new bit of Star Trek to analyze, doesn't it? This one is on Screen Rant, and Screen Rant, they did a breakdown of the trailer, but just one thing that they said in there caught my eye. They said, with Discovery being built up as a bigger, grittier take on the long-running franchise, it appears that CBS may have created the most ambitious Star Trek series yet. And it just made me pause because I'm thinking about the other series, and I'm especially thinking about what they did with Deep Space Nine. Do you think this is going to be the most ambitious Star Trek series yet, or is that just a bit of hyperbole by media who wants to play up what's going on with the show?
That's a good way to put it. I think that's a fair statement. For one thing, it's the state of, we've already said this, it's the state of production today. We're sitting here thinking about our Star Trek and what we hope it would be. CBS is, on one hand, trying to launch a service, a network, but at the other hand, there is a lot of, and I say this, there's a lot of ego. My God, we always laugh about the fan wars, right, between the franchises. I always think they're overhyped. And, of course, it's about profit. But at the same time, there's a lot of corporate pride. And CBS has inherited this because of the Viacom divorce. But the CBS Paramount family has a lot of pride in Star Trek. And on one hand, yes, very capitalistically wants to make sure it's earning as much money as it can. But at the same time, they're probably tired of Star Wars and Marvel and DC and Harry Potter and Doctor Who and what, you know, go down the list of all of those. You know, there's our friends in consumer products are really tired of not being able to walk into Target and Walmart and see Star Trek action figures on the wall. So I think there's a lot of I don't say franchise competition, corporate competition, you know, beyond just the purely money, but that's all there. And that's why, and we've seen that already. Again, they're not skimping on the budget. They're not skimping on demands, on over deadlines. You mentioned DS9. Aside from the investment they made in the sets, we used to say, you know, the Promenade was the biggest set in Hollywood. And it, I mean, it was for a TV series, standing sets. But my God, no series has ever shot in Jordan. That was a trivia point from the day. None of the series had. Mm-hmm. Barely the only the JJ era has a movie gone outside North America. So I think that's a fair statement. I don't know who would dispute that. I mean, again, we haven't seen the whole run of the show. Maybe they shot the wad on the pilot and then went cheapo bottle on the other 13 hours.
But probably did
another DS9, you know, car. But I don't think so, because they know it's got a hold of. Because I really think they're looking also, you know, the Emmys and the award season. This is their shot across the bow to compete with Game of Thrones on a purely, again, ego/capitalistic level, make the stockholders happy. But it makes everybody happy when it's done right. It's like I've said the last 10, 12 years, this is the first time in ages that the corporate and the fan interests behind the CBS corporate interests and the fan interests have been so aligned, you know, as far as the whole struggle between mm-hmm. Bad Robot commanding of the franchise and CBS retaining the legacy aspects. And we've all been on the same side of the fence, which has been an interesting take. And I think this is, we may quibble about individual creative decisions, and there may be a faction that's always going to be pissed about it being on the streaming paid service separate. But in the big stream of things, that's awesome.
Except that, you know, probably after a season ends, probably 3 to 6 months later, it's going to come out on Blu-ray.
Of course.
So you'll be able to buy the season for $20.
Yeah.
So if you don't want to pay for it up front and you want to just be patient and just wait for that season to end, you'll be able to pick it up that way. So if you want to see it, you're going to be able to see it. It's just a question of, do you want to pay $5 a month up front, or do you want to wait and pick it up on home video later?
But yeah, you mentioned that it's Netflix branding. It's, you know, Moonves has already said months ago that the Netflix pre-sales, they funded half the show, half the series, just from the Netflix pre-sales for the contract. So
Netflix.
Yes.
Netflix got their Netflix.
That's Star for sure. Trek, no, got no, its
CBS got their Netflix.
I was going to say, Star Trek got its Netflix. Yeah.
All right. Well, those are some basic points. We're going to wrap up because we've been talking about the trailer for quite a long time.
Can I say this real quickly, though? Real quickly. No one has pointed this out.
Oh, yeah. I want to hear about this.
It's a very cool moment when it's kind of simplistic graphics, or not simplistic graphics.
Yeah.
I worry about the interface. But the moment when the generic warp signatures pop up as Klingon on the display, and he says, oh, it's Klingon signatures. We've got Klingon ships, whatever. I was looking because they had some stars. I know this is one of my corners, right? There's a star map behind there. And the second time through, I went, oh, I wonder if they pulled up from our, you know, Mike/Jeff/my star charts. And I went to look and I saw, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, W, which is a real star. And I went, mm-hmm. wait. And then I started looking and it's like, and the line, which I thought was some kind of like a trade route or some kind of a patrol route or something. I looked again. Mm-hmm. I went, wait a minute. That's like one of the dippers. And I went, W is a real star. And then it dawned on me. They had taken it. It's Ursa Major. It's the Big Dipper, which means it's but when you're talking about constellations that we know, that's like the star patterns as seen from Earth. That's not like a deep space chart. So I was like, oh, guys, maybe you can fix that by the time you air. Because it looks like somebody got a star chart stuck down and put all the cool animation on top of it. Now, whatever you want to say about the interface, but the underlying star map, I was like, ooh, that's a little wrong, guys. You should like come up with just fictional stars. But they were all clearly labeled, you know? They were all the...
Yeah, well, that's
they were all the stars of the Big Dipper. Yeah. But I've not seen anybody in... I was even reading some real space.com and some sites had some real space things were covering the trailer, which is cool. Mm-hmm. But nobody else mentioned that.
One more follow-up. Last time you and I were talking, we were debating the pronunciation of the USS Shenzhou.
Yes.
And I did confirm since then, a friend of mine here in Tokyo, another journalist, Richard Smart, gave me the exact correct pronunciation. It is Chinese, and I was close. It's the ZH is not zhe, but zhe, but it is Shenzhou. as I was saying, it probably was. Now, how they pronounce it on the show, I don't know. They might, you know, we've seen actors, you know, they couldn't even decide how to pronounce Bajor for a while.
Right,
so
right.
I don't know where they're going to go with it. But in terms of the place in China, it is Shenzhou.
I'm sure all the Vulcanians know how to say it.
Exactly. Especially how to say it in Klingonese.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there's our quick rundown of the trailer. We'll see where it goes. You know, the show may be for you. It may not be for you. It may be great. It may not be great. It's probably going to depend very much on personal taste and how we can each reconcile what we're seeing with all the Star Trek that we know up to this point. But at least from what I see, they're certainly giving it their best effort, I think, to make something great.
It's obviously going to be very lush and lavish and competitive, but it's very early. It's still early. There will be other trailers that aren't designed to sell ads. So
exactly.
Right.
And we'll see where that goes. All right. Well, Larry, let's go ahead and jump into the feature. We're going to be joined by Bruce Gibson and Kay Elizabeth Shaw to talk about Voyager's workforce.
Oh, cool.
We all want to escape from our lives sometimes. Well, what if you really could do it? And what if you couldn't remember the life you left? And what if it was all against your will? That's what happens to the crew of the Starship Voyager in the seventh season episode, Workforce. And today we're going to discuss this episode and bring you a few behind-the-scenes bits of info. And to help us do that, we're joined by co-host of our books and comics show, Literary Treks, Bruce Gibson. Welcome, Bruce.
Thanks for having me, Chris. And I just have to say, I'm very impressed with the pull and power you have with CBS, because when you had your eye situation, they delayed Star Trek Discovery to give
right?
you time
yeah.
to recover. And now we're mm-hmm. at a point that things look good, that they're, you know, said, okay, we'll do it this fall.
But notice that I still have one more surgery to go either late summer or early autumn. And they say the show's coming this fall. They haven't given a date yet because my surgery hasn't been scheduled yet. Yes.
Absolutely. That's just so impressive.
Right. Oh, Bruce, thanks a lot. I wasn't going to tell him and not swell his head. But oh, so now it's out. So, okay.
So thoughtful. Okay, Bruce, it's good to have you here today. And also joining us to bring you that truly Delta Quadrant perspective, joining us in the wee hours of the morning from the UK, is co-host of our Voyager show, To the Journey, Kay Elizabeth Shaw. Hey, Kay, welcome.
Hi, Chris. Hi, it's great to be here. Yeah, I hadn't realized that about Discovery until Bruce pointed it out, but it's just so obvious now.
Yeah, we've been trying to keep that under wraps. You know, they didn't want to, you know, set a precedent for this kind of thing for the next series or
sure.
anything like that. So, all right. So today we're going to talk about Workforce, which is another one of those Star Trek stories in which the characters don't remember who they are. But at least this time, it comes at the end of the series when we actually do know something about the characters, unlike The Naked Now, for example, where, oh, the Enterprise crew's acting weird, but we don't know much about them anyway, so are they really acting weird, or does Yar really have a thing for androids? I don't know. But this comes in the seventh season of Voyager, so let's start off with our initial thoughts about the episode. And Kay, since you are from our Voyager show, why don't you kick us off?
Well, I quite like this episode, actually, which will probably surprise people, because I think we've got a reputation over onto the journey of having a bit of a Janeway Chakotay thing. And obviously this kind of flies in the face of that a bit. But it's quite interesting. And I do, there are some great bits in this episode that I know we're going to go into much more detail on. But it's really interesting to see them out of their comfort zone. In the sense of they're not in the situation we're used to seeing them in, but yet somehow they're still the characters that we recognize. So I quite like seeing that.
That's what that selective changing of memory engrams will do for you.
Yeah.
All right, Bruce, how about you? Initial thoughts?
I also like the episode. I liked it because at first I thought, well, is the crew undercover? or did they really lose their memories and not know who they are? And then once we find out that they don't remember who they are, it was cool to see how the crew members started to put pieces together and start to bond with each other and work as a group to overcome the issue and try to figure out what was really going on with them. And then to see what was going on with like Chakotay and Kim and the Doctor and, you know, back on, and Neelix back on Voyager. So you kind of had two stories going on at different times. So I liked how it all came together.
Larry, how about you? Maybe your thoughts are what you thought when you saw this episode coming down the pipe back at the time.
Yes, Chris, television had been invented by then and had not ended as Data predicted. No, it was interesting, you know, rewatching this again, because in context at the time, which nobody gets if you're just sitting down to watch this on your DVDs or your Netflix or wherever you're getting it, is that this was seventh season, right? And so on one hand, the kind of, you know, fish out of water contrast, kind of a plot where you take everybody and plop them into different situations and let them go is the thing that, like you said, it's not naked now. It is not only is it a mature series, it's the last year. But this was aired February of the last season. So this was like a big sweep show. They spent a lot of money on it. But it was about what, five, six, half dozen from the end. So right. At the time they made this, at the time they shot it, at the time they produced it, everybody's thoughts are on the series ending. I mean, emotionally, they're all showing up doing their jobs. But from the writers to the actors to the crew to everybody, they know that the series is winding down. It's sentimental. It's bittersweet. And on a very practical sense, a lot of people are thinking about their jobs coming up. And a lot of people are putting in, you know, they're working very hard and putting in their professionalism as always. But they can't help but know that this is getting down to the end. So, and some people who are going to work on Enterprise coming up, and some people who don't know if they are, and some people who are maybe doing all they can to get a job, and some people know that they're not, you know, coming back, whether they're an extra in a stand-in or whether there's somebody on the design staff or the producers are right, whatever. So that's kind of an undercurrent of this. So on one hand, it's like the freedom where they can go out and have a big episode like this and spend money on all those costumes that they had to do from scratch. Those weren't like really repurposed, and the sets that they built and the big power plant set. But on the other hand, you have to know that that's informing all the performances and the writing too, is that,
yeah,
you know, sentimentally and also in a paranoid Hollywood, you know, entertainment kind of way, people that's undercurrenting it. So
when Janeway says, "I can already tell that this is going to be much better than my last job," she was referring to being on Voyager and then what she was going to do after.
Right. She wasn't talking about Mrs. Columbo. So,
well, let me ask you one more question. Did any of the people working on Voyager resort to plastic surgery to get jobs on Enterprise?
Only Mike Westmore and Mike Akuta, strangely enough. But no, I'm kidding. No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
On Memory Alpha now, Larry.
That was the test case. Well, I guess those Memory Alpha entries are just going to bloom after tonight.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about the actual story a little bit, and then we'll get into some more background information. But as I mentioned, this is one of those stories where people can't remember who they are. And we've talked about already that they start to put the pieces together a little bit. And it's interesting how that happens, because the setup at the beginning, like you said, Bruce, you don't know if they're undercover or if they don't remember who they are. And it seems like Janeway is undercover at first. That's sort of the setup in the beginning of episode one. And then you quickly realize as you get into the story that no, they really don't know why they're there, and they don't remember very much about their past lives. So then it makes me wonder, when I go back to Janeway and what she says at the beginning about this will be much better than my last job, what does she think her last job was? You know, are they implanting some sort of false memories of a life leading up to that point into these people? It raises some interesting questions. But what I'd like to talk about right now is how the characters put the pieces together, and we see the sort of personality parallels. And, you know, Tom gets quickly dismissed from his job, just in the same way he couldn't stay with Starfleet.
Slacker.
And with Tuvok, you see all these emotions coming out. And is that happening because the changes to his memory and Graham's have allowed the Vulcan emotions to come to the surface? You know, what is happening there? So, Kay, which character moment stands out most to you in terms of how the characters are like the people we know, even though they don't remember who they are?
I think Tom's probably the one that strikes me the most, really, out of everyone, how similar he is to himself, because he's grown a lot by this point. And I think the sort of throwaway bit at the beginning where we get him talking about how, oh, I only lasted half a day, you know, that's a nice little early indicator that actually they are kind of still who we recognize. But I just really like when he approaches B'Elanna for the first time. And we get this sense of the fact that even though they don't remember who they are, there's still this innate kind of connection between them and they're drawn to each other. And I love that. That's probably my favorite thing about this episode.
How about you, Bruce?
The characters that I thought were least like themselves were B'Elanna and Tuvok. B'Elanna seemed little down and depressed, almost like the first time you see her, she walks into that bar restaurant area and she starts to walk in and then she turns around and leaves as if she's intimidated or she's shy. So she seemed very standoffish, which B'Elanna can be, but in a less feisty way. And then, of course, Tuvok is laughing and kidding around, and it's even mentioned that he's bad at telling jokes, even though he tries to.
But he has some humorous anecdotes for you, Bruce.
He does, doesn't he?
But he's not, he didn't get to tell them.
We never find out
so
what they are.
I was so disappointed.
No. Right. We'll have to buy his joke book when it comes out.
Oh, that's what we need. We have all these new Star Trek books coming out right now. Tuvok's book of humorous anecdotes with a foreword by Data.
Yeah, I would definitely get that. We could do it on Literary Trek.
People could see Kay doing her hands like from the outrageous O'Connor. That's awesome.
But then, you know, the other characters seemed like themselves, even though they don't remember themselves. And Janeway, at first I thought she was Wilma from Buck Rogers, the way she was dressed. Like in the Erin Gray blue jumpsuit.
Second season Buck Rogers.
Yes, exactly. I swear.
What if Tweaky had been there as an assistant?
Big one. Beady, 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 beady. Okay, Tom. Wait, what? Yeah, it was this bar. Yeah.
But I do like also when they ask 7 of 9, when she's first introduced, do you have a number or a name? And of course, you're expecting her to say a number, 7 of 9 or something. And she's like, no, Annika Hansen. And it's like, oh, okay, we're going with the name. Cool.
But when she did mention her employee number, I started trying to figure out if that could be turned into 7 and 9 in any way.
Yeah. In base 47, that translates as 7 of 9.
I wish they would have given her the number 8472.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. That would have been great. No matter what they did, there's no way that they could have topped the fantastically secretive alias of Amal Kote.
Yeah.
That was I told you it was 7 season fatigue kicking in. That was like the high point of the non-art department cleverness was the, you know, from out of the heart building writers. That was it.
I'm just picturing a late night in the writer's room with drinks. Like, we've got to come up with a name for him. Well, how about Amal Kote? Works for me. Let's go on to the next scene.
Ken is running the writers because, you know, Brannon is over with Rick working on Enterprise, and it's all Ken's baby to just kind of bring it home. And people are like, but what about? And so finally somebody calls over and says, will you just write the damn thing? It's just a Voyager. Would you just do it and get out of here?
No. It's like if Janeway's name on the show had been like Kat Ainway.
Or Nicole.
Yeah. That would work.
Yeah.
Very good.
All right. So, Larry, what do you think about the characters in terms of how they were played and them seeming like the characters we know, even though they don't remember who they are?
Well, you were talking about B'Elanna not being, it just dawned on me kind of going back through this. Of course, Chakotay is a control subject because he didn't get sucked in. Mm. But it kind of struck me at first that you see Tom breaking down first, and then B'Elanna, they get to the ship, is one of the first ones that's pulled in. So it's like the Maquis, or the key Maquis people, are the ones who have, you know what I'm saying? It just, I didn't think about that at the time. Not all by device or by design, but it was just kind of interesting that way. I don't know. I was watching Janeway and kept comparing. It's like, okay, how is she with her holographic real boyfriend versus her real fake boyfriend? How does that play out differently? Oh, please, boys, give me a romance. Give me a romance this season. And yeah, how would it be different when they're not all dressed in green, but they're in turquoise, or she's in turquoise?
It would be slightly different, Larry.
This is what happens when you give me a character question. See, No, but I did think it was interesting that it's like the Maquis people were breaking down, either by design or by choice. The Maquis were breaking down faster than the more stalwart Starfleet folk were.
Anyway, Tuvok is the first person who starts to really remember what had happened to them, and logically breaking down the joke about a species that doesn't have fathers, and how silly that person was for not understanding the procreation rituals of that race.
Well, you're stopping. But see, there's no well, we can get into this, but it's funny. This show suffers a little bit from the same thing that Tsun Katsi does, where they did a great job of, and I don't want to jump into background too much, they did a great job of recycling some of the Delta Quadrant aliens for all the background people. And how they used even disguises for some of the Voyager people to be in altered alien species disguises. But there are a couple of Alpha Quadrant people in the background, too, that even Memory Alpha has flagged. So
back to Tuvok. Polish Bolian.
Right. It's the atmosphere on Quora.
I think that's what happens when Bolians get suntans.
That's what that is. they have a vitamin deficiency, but from the tetrionic radiation emitting from the power plant. But Tuvok, Vulcans, no one knows what a Vulcan is. No one knows, you know, who knows where Vork is running around.
Yeah.
But no one knows what a Vulcan is. So when they're what does that do to, you know, it's part, Vulcans are part physiology, part emotional. So it was an interesting choice the way they have it be doing that, but then also to be the one that breaks. And so is his one foot in each world, even more so on his human side.
Yeah.
Not his human side, I'm Spock. His human experience.
Human exposure.
His wannabe-ness having them put him that far, maybe they didn't know. They just kind of ran him through the processor, you know, one size fits all, basically. And for that extreme kind of a species, you know, physiological as well as emotional. That's why he was cracking first.
It's because he doesn't have emotions that are suppressed. And then whatever they did to him, his emotions have come up to the forefront to the point that he has changed the most. And so therefore he psychologically is breaking.
He's the rubber band.
Yes.
That's the easiest to snap.
Yes.
But Bruce, when you say that he doesn't have emotions to suppress, you're saying that because he's pure Vulcan, he doesn't have emotions?
No, I'm saying he has emotions. They are suppressed.
Oh, they are suppressed.
They are suppressed, but now they're on the forefront.
You're right.
Which he's not used to. And so that's the biggest personality change, and that's what breaks him.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. And Larry, as a parallel with him laughing as the emotional guard is dropped, a parallel to the original series, The Sight of Paradise, we see Spock letting go under the influence of the pollen. Could that be a callback? I mean, that's...
Let's not get carried away, Chris.
When I see Tuvok laughing, it feels like, you know, that's a connection there. Because Spock is half human, so he has human emotions, but we know that Vulcan emotions are actually stronger, so maybe that's why Tuvok is maybe overdoing the laughter a little bit in this scene.
Well, I mean, it's fun to speculate on that. As far as what was really going on there, Ken and Brian and Brian Fuller co-wrote this. They have the original credit on part one, and then they handed it to Ken. Co-wrote part two with Michael Taylor from their story. Maybe Brian, that was in his, I didn't ever talk to Brian about the seventh season, but maybe that was in his mindset. Maybe that was a fun thing that they flashed on. But I wouldn't bet the farm on it.
Especially not the farm from this side of paradise.
Right, right. But for us to sit here and filter it that way, oh, that's fine. Let's run with it.
Of course, Larry. Let's run with it.
Let's run with it.
So I want to address the comment about the Alpha Quadrant aliens in the background. This is one thing that's always kind of bothered me about Star Trek. It's like, if we see other humans on other planets, that seems to be okay. But if you see another species with pointed ears, you're like, well, that's a Vulcan. Well, there could be other Vulcan looking type species out other parts of the galaxy and
well, there are Mentalkins, Bruce.
Well, there you go. So if you see anybody in the background that looks like an Alpha Quadrant alien, they could just be a Delta or Gamma or whatever quadrant alien, just a different planet or what. They're not even associated with one another.
We just talk about how those preservers were busy little beavers.
They were.
You think they were only seeding humans and humanoids?
Right. No.
Yeah.
All right. Well, early on as well, you know, some things I noticed too. Of course, Seven would become the new efficiency monitor for the power facility. And of course, she doesn't want anyone to have fun and she wants them to get their work done. And Tom, one of the way that they bring B'Elanna back later in the story, in the second part, is of course take her to Voyager and remind her of her life there, remind her that she's married to Tom, and then she starts to piece things together, and she mentions maybe that's why he was so concerned about me. Of course, he doesn't remember, I think, that he's married to her, but there's something interesting there, the subconscious ties that all of these characters have together. Which is why when I mentioned at the beginning that this is in the seventh season and we actually know the characters, this kind of story can work on that level because at least they have the relationships and we know what the relationships are. Kay, do you have any thoughts on those interactions between Tom and B'Elanna?
I just, literally just the second that he walks up to her and talks to her, you just sense the relationship straight away. And obviously, as viewers knowing their sort of history and how they are together, we see that straight away. It's quite interesting because he's just really friendly with her and she's instantly resistant, but he just manages to charm her quite quickly. I like that. I just like how she's just charmed by him.
It's kind of a microcosmic replay of their entire relationship.
Yeah. It is actually. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because it does look like that when you point it out. It really does. She's sort of like, no, you're obviously somebody who's got intentions towards me that might not be entirely proper or whatever. Because I think to begin with, she's like, are you sure that you want to be sort of going down this road when I'm pregnant and so on, and what is it that you're actually after? And then he's like, oh, well, obviously you're not interested in a romantic relationship, but maybe you need a friend. And she just instantly, you see how she's like, oh, actually, maybe I misjudged you a bit. Maybe you're a bit nicer than I originally thought. I thought you were just this kind of playboy, but you're not. And yeah, that does reflect how they go on their journey down the road.
I wish he would have asked her, who's the father? She would have been like, I don't know.
I blanked it from my mind. It was a trauma.
That's an interesting point because he does say, you're married. And she says, no. But as I mentioned at the beginning of the discussion, these Quora scientists, this doctor, when they're altering the minds, what are they doing? Do people show up at this power facility with amnesia? They don't know how they got there. They don't know who they are. That doesn't seem to be the case. They seem to know. They have selective facts.
No, they backloaded them with a biography.
Hmm. Well, see, that's what
they have
to feel.
Yeah.
But to what extent? Because you get the feeling, like with B'Elanna, that she's pregnant, she's not married, and she shows up in this power facility and maybe she doesn't know what happened in this one area of her life. I don't know. And that may be why she's very guarded towards Tom.
Yeah.
Yet they remember where they're from because, you know, they're saying they're from Earth. So what is in their memory or what is in their minds on how they got to where they are now? Something had to be implanted there. And then if somebody asks Seven of Nine, what are those implants on her? I wonder what she would answer.
Yeah.
May I jump in here with something that might have been the intention of helping clear that up?
Of course, Larry.
So, okay. Nope. Get out of here. This was a very spare show, but in Workforce Part 2, I should have looked at call sheets and seen if they filmed this, but at least they wrote in the final draft. In Part 2, when Neelix, when they have B'Elanna aboard Voyager, and they're trying to get her there, and they're in... There's a scene in engineering where Kim is working and Neelix is basically trying to re-engage her memory by getting her into engineering. And there's a whole scene where Neelix walks into engineering with her and he's like, "You remember Harry?" And Harry's like underneath trying to work on something. And she's, "Well, he doesn't remember you." "Well, he's a very good friend of yours. And aside from you, there's nobody better with a hyperspanner." And he says, "Well, not today." And Kim's like, "Oh, I've been trying to boost our comm range, but the primary relays keep shorting out." And Neelix says, "Maybe B'Elanna could help you." And he's like, "Well, blah, 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 blah." He said, Kim says, "Every time I try increasing the amperage, I end up," and Torres says, "You have to realign the induction coils to handle the extra power." And then they're all like looking at her. And Neelix says, "See, you do know." And then she gets confused and she says, "Look, your doctor pokes me with medical instruments. You introduce me to strangers. You tell me they're friends. For all I know, you're the ones trying to manipulate my memories." And Neelix says, "I'm sorry. I know this is hard, but..." And Torres says, "What I remember is stepping off a transport 2 weeks ago and finding a good job." And Neelix says, "Before that?" He says, "What do you mean? Before you boarded that transport, what was your life like?" She says, "I was on Kessick 4. I was pregnant. I was unemployed. I was alone, wishing I could find a better home for myself and my baby." And he says, "You already had a home." "Oh, yeah. According to you, it's 30,000 light years away." "No, I'm not talking about Earth. I'm talking about right here on Voyager." And that was the scene. And it was cut because... Okay. It wasn't needed, but what that gets to is they intended it in their backstory subtext. They intended to give them.
Yeah.
And what's as I read this tonight again for the first time, Kessick 4 was her real world colony,
right?
Back home. So unless there was another Kessick 4, or they didn't care or whatever, I didn't. That's not why they obviously cut this, because it was they didn't need the time and they had to find some time to trim.
Yeah, except that. The scene is helpful in that it clears up this question about are they backloading them. But the information that they backload them with is sometimes a little bit off. I mean, Janeway talks about all the problems on Earth and how there are all these little islands in which she's referring to groups of people. It's kind of like 2017, groups of people who can't get along with each other and they're fighting all the time, which is not the Earth that she comes from in the 24th century. So... where is that memory coming from? It's like they're probing their minds and then they're crafting this backstory for them, but the details might be a little bit off. And that also, Larry, sets up when Chakotay asks them, "How are you sending a comm signal from 8 light years away?" And Harry says, or the doctor gives some technobabble explanation and then they say it was B'Elanna's idea. Mm-hmm. That's all the tweaking they were doing in that scene.
That may have been the scene that was intended to tie that down, if in case anybody was curious about it, and then it got wiped out. Like but didn't sink the show.
I think that what they've done is actually manipulated it purposely to make them feel like where they're going to be is better. So they've made them remember that their life was awful, so that now they're in the power plant. They're like, "Oh, it's great here, isn't it wonderful? Haven't we got these wonderful jobs and so on?" So I think that's kind of they've manipulated that to make them want to be there.
"I have cancer from the Tetrions, but it's such much better cancer than I had back home."
"Because now I get inoculations."
"I know I get them."
On schedule, free of charge.
I kept wondering Janeway's relationship with Jaffin, that he was in on this whole plan, that he was romancing her to try to get her to stay and not try to regress in certain memories. Like he was part of the plan, that he knew what was going on with the crew. And so, we got to keep the captain at bay and make her happy and want to stay here just in case memories start to come back. So start having a romantic relationship with her. And then we find out, he didn't know any of that, that he really was interested in Wilma from Buck Rogers. I mean, Janeway from Voyager.
Right. Well, that's an interesting point, because I actually have never read the episode that way. I've always read it as him just being interested in her from the start. And my bigger question, which is the next thing on the outline, romantically, Kate, is why does Janeway let her guard down so quickly and start falling for Jaffin? because this seems very out of character for her. But then if I really think about it, I think about the beginning of Voyager, and she's separated from Mark, and then it takes her quite a while to adjust to the separation, but eventually she does. She feels responsible for stranding the crew in the Delta Quadrant, and she has the isolation of command. And I also think that there is something there between her and Chakotay, but she would never let it be known. Mm. So it's just lying under the surface. And here, when she's got this new background and she has this new life, that aspect of her personality suddenly comes out, and it's like she's longing for a different life from the one that she left on Voyager.
Yeah.
Well, there's so many levels there that, you know, she has the normal captain, like you said, the normal captain isolation of command. Then she's got the isolated command and the Chakotay, all that. What we don't know, see, Chris, is that, and, you know, Geri Taylor didn't even get this loaded into her bio books that she wrote about Janeway. But I mean, Mark was just the latest in a long line. She had a guy a year. See, so what we're seeing here in the Colonel Wilma Deering outfit is just, she's reverting to form is what she's doing. So don't worry too much about it. Well, no, I'm totally kidding.
The answer,
the long line of Janeway loves. There's another novel to come out.
It's just, hey, that gothic, the Oregon Trail, the gothic that then turned into, yeah, the gothic.
She's yeah. like Kirk, right? She's got somebody in every port.
That's right. Right.
She's just never seen their language before. That's all.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I think the answer to this is the very last scene that she has on the ship with Jaffin. She can't pursue the relationship. I mean, it's open to her. He could come with them, but she basically says no because she knows her role as captain and that isolation we were talking about. But her being on the planet, I almost feel like it's like Tuvok. There's like an emotional release because he suppressed it in himself, where Janeway's suppressing relationships as a captain. And now that she doesn't remember anything, they're just coming to the forefront. And it's the first guy that looks at her. She says, well, you know, I'm a little tired, but I'll come see you some other time. And then she develops the relationship.
It surprised me how quickly she agreed to move in with him.
Like I said, you strip all that away and she reverts to form. No, I'm kidding.
I think it definitely feels like it's an element of herself that she's been suppressing. And it's like she's suddenly got this freedom and she's reveling in it to an extent. I feel like the whole thing is summarized really nicely, actually, by a little line that is said between her and Chakotay once he shows up, which is he says to her, oh, you could probably run that power plant. And she says, why would I want the responsibility? And I just think that's incredibly telling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's obviously, you know, there's something in there that's tired, I think, after 7 years of this endless responsibility where she's constantly having to compromise herself for the mission that she's set for herself.
Now, Neelix doesn't get sucked into this, so he can't take over as a cook in a bar or anything like that. And so it seems to be left to Janeway to do the cooking around here. How did that turn out, Kay?
Not well at all. And it turns out whether she has a replicator or whether she has some other method of creating food, she's just still terrible at it. I love that she's cooked this meal and she's like, oh, it'll be fine if we scrape off the burnt bits. And you see Jaffa just take a forkful and he's like, yeah, it's nice. And she's like, we can totally just go out for dinner.
See, reverting to form. See, I'm telling you.
Exactly, yeah.
She's the one that's the closest.
Oh, maybe that was a key moment where she started doubting the situation, where she thought, that's right, I can't cook. When has this happened before?
Yeah.
But why is she so insistent that she has to cook dinner in the first place?
Well, that is funny, isn't it? Because
I mean, that's not something that she normally does.
Well, no, because she normally burns it, but... She's always enthusiastic about the idea of wanting to cook. So maybe it is something she likes the idea of being able to do, but she can't actually do it. So she's forgotten that she's awful at it.
Yeah, because she doesn't remember she's cooked. Have I cooked before? I can't remember. I'll give it a try.
And her great engrammatic supervisor in the sky is, oh my God, cooking. I knew there was something I forgot.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
you know, that thread.
We missed out the bit where she's awful at cooking.
It could be a new show for Neelix's entertainment network that he has on Voyager, and it could be like MasterChef Delta Quadrant. Mm. And Neelix could be the master chef who tells you that what you made is crap and throws it across the room. And Janeway could be a competitor. And then Harry could be a competitor as well. And when he pulls open the box, and what you've got there is you've got water and you've got meat, and you have a meat byproduct, and you have to come up with a gourmet recipe, and he remembers this drink that he had. Fala Nectar has a great sounding name, but I guess maybe the animal that it comes from is the fala. It is the nectar of fala.
Okay, see, fala, I'm either thinking of FDR's dog or I'm thinking of Fallout, and I go back to the radiation and I go back to the Tetrions.
Apparently it's Fallout, considering how it affected Harry's stomach.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's what I think that was the intention there, Chris. I think
also during that late night in the writer's room.
Yeah, it was an odd little thing that they threw that in there, because it didn't really have any relationship to anything else that was going on. It was just this, oh, let's just, you know, make something awful happen to Harry again because it's funny.
Yeah, we can't make Harry a hero. Well, it was, you know?
it's the torture Harry. I mean, if this had been DS9, they would have given the drink to Miles.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Right. It's Geordi. It's Miles. It's
yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, we haven't done anything horrible to Harry for a few episodes. Let's just come up with this horrendous idea, which just, oh, it's horrible.
It was in line with Neelix's character, though, where he thinks that a drink made from a meat byproduct is no big deal.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, and then he tries to cure his bad stomach by giving him Leola Bark tea, obviously.
Which Harry won't drink, but
which Harry refuses to drink.
I don't know how they do it over there in the UK, but my mother always told me a nice cup of hot Leola Bark tea can cure anything.
Yeah, I think we're more on the chamomile over here, but yeah, Leola Bark. I guess they're interchangeable. It depends how much you like yourself.
Kay, I hate to tell you this, but you know that picture they put on the boxes of the chamomile tea with the flower? That's just to make it easier for you to stomach. It's actually from a meat byproduct.
Right. I did always think it tasted a little bit strange. You've made that one make sense for me now.
You know, now that I'm thinking about it, that whole thing about that meat byproduct drink doesn't really add anything to the story. So it would have been really cool if they would have just found out that the drink helps them get their memories back and they all have to drink it when they come up to the ship.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
Yeah.
And they take it down to the power facility, and Chakotay and Neelix, they have many, many cups of it that stashed away, and they have to trick Janeway and Seven and Tuvok into drinking it in the power facility.
It's the Fala Nectar syndrome save or whatever. The FS.
Yeah.
Yeah. That went nowhere. Okay.
This is starting to sound like a To the Journey rewrite now.
All right. We do plenty of at least surgical rewrites on the Ready Room. Okay.
I'm just thinking more of it as a bit out there.
While we're on the topic of characters, let's talk about the Doctor for a minute, because he gets to be the emergency command hologram once again. It's his second time. It's a dream come true for him. How do you think he did this time around?
I think he does better, actually. I do like the interplay between him and Harry, and how Harry's like, no, why should I just accept the fact that you're in charge because you've decided you're going to write this extra program, and they have this nice little argument about it. I quite like that. But he does pretty well, you know. I mean, he comes up with some pretty good strategies, and even Harry admits that in the end. But I do like the way that he sort of, he just prunes, he sort of fluffs himself around like a sort of prize chicken. He's just like, he's just so loving it, isn't he? He's just like, you don't quite know why he's doing it. Is it the glory? Is it the praise? You know, he just wants to be a hero. He just loves this idea of being a hero in his own story, and he's just incredibly theatrical as a character, and everything's just a performance. That's what I love about him, and it almost feels like this is like him just living out some fantasy. It's just fab.
She did say, go ahead and keep playing around with this program. She didn't tell him to shut it down in Tinker Tailor. So.
Yeah.
Well, I think he made some great decisions. I think he could serve as a command officer. And it made me wonder why not just leave him in that role and duplicate him as a doctor and have two of him around, one a command version, one a doctor version. And then I thought, well, maybe they can't.
Bruce, do you really think that the crew could handle two of him running around the ship?
No.
No. No, not really.
That's much funnier than thinking. That's much funnier than thinking about, like, what would be the memory data demands of having two. Of course, the command wouldn't have to know, like, 47 billion surgery routines and the medical side. It would just be strategies and tactics. But
well, my next thought too was that, well, why not just make duplicate doctors, because he doesn't have a sick bay with, you know, multiple medical personnel. But then I thought, well, if there was like two EMHs or three of him, they'd all be arguing with each other all the time and probably nothing exactly. would get done. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But I wasn't even sure if he could make a duplicate, but he does ask, I think it was Harry, he asked, you know, just leave me as I am as command and make a duplicate of me as a doctor. And so obviously, yeah, I guess
he wants to write a new program. A new EMH program.
But can you see the EMH trying to relieve the ECH of command based on medical basis? And
that would be a good episode.
That would be entertaining. Yeah.
And of course, Bob Picardo would have to play both parts. Oh my God, it would be, yeah. He'd take that in a heartbeat.
He'd love that.
Mm-hmm. I'd certify that right now.
Let me ask you guys a question about the overall story, because I actually watched this two-parter over the past couple of weeks. I watched it three times to refresh my memory for this. And when I was watching it last night for the third time, and I was taking notes, and I got towards the end, and maybe halfway through the second episode, I wrote down, honestly, I find this story meandering. Like, what's the point of this story? If you just watch it, okay, well, here are some people who don't remember who they are, and they're in this power facility and their crewmates are trying to rescue them. It's an okay story, but as a Star Trek episode after 7 years of Voyager, it sort of felt to me like, what's the point? And then after I thought about it, I kind of came up with something, but I'm curious before I tell you what I came up with, what you think about that statement.
Well, I had two thoughts. One was, I was saying at the beginning that it was seventh season. It's the maturity point of a show where actually, you know, after 4 or 5 years, you're there. And they were doing this before, but it struck me how Voyager is the Trek series that was not back home, and how all the series, including Enterprise, including DS9, dabbled in the mirror universe, had all the local politics to play with. But Voyager was the one that cut itself off from the local species, Klingons, Romulans, and like, figuratively, there would have been a mirror universe in the Delta Quadrant. Just, I don't know. See Kazons without goatees or something. I don't know.
Kazon who have, like, really flat hair. Like bowl cuts. Flat,
right, yeah. Right. Little 50s CIA cuts, like Bob Haldeman kind of hair. But it's like, but you think about this. You think of, what is it, Living Witness? Mm. You think how many times are people I've gone blank on the episode where people misjudge them. But you think how many times that on the Silver Blood aliens, you think how many times that Voyager, it's like the impetus as a series, as a sci-fi series, as a Star Trek series, they had all the mirror universe, alternate universe impulses to go there, the writers, producers, but they didn't do the mirror universe, but they made one up. And this is another case where, you know, it's that whole thing of, as a universe, as a canon thing, it's an alternate universe. As an acting piece, as a performance piece, it's, oh, let's let the actors go run crazy and be an opposite, you know, get out of their rut and be something else. And the crew has fun with it, and the designers have fun with it, and everybody has fun. It's a vacation in the middle of having to work. And so Voyager never got to do that the same way everybody else would do that. Mm-hmm. So they have all those episodes where they're doing this, where they're in an alternate universe of sorts. Or they're on the holodeck being Klingons and, you know, Horosian fighters at the Horosian's whim, and you get it that way. Or they're Borg, whatever. But even though this was Voyager, the show that was lost in the Delta Quadrant far away, they still had all the same storytelling impulses. But maybe this is a good time to say this. So I was as I said, seventh season was a really piss poor time to try to get people to talk about Voyager because people were out the door or gone or whatever. And I never had any reason to do some big time work on this. But I did find some comments here from Ken Biller, who was show running the show the last season when Brannon stepped back to develop Enterprise. And here's an angle that I don't know when I saw it the first time, much less this rewatch and what we're all talking about here, if this even came up. So maybe it rings a bell with you, Chris, maybe not, or, and you guys. Basically, he had that impulse. I'm just going to read what I got it for. He says, we had this idea. What if these people that had been on this horrible quest, what if they just could live a normal life, just the normal, average, everyday, average people? And there was a lot in the news then about illegal immigration. This was nearly 20 years ago. There was a lot in the news about illegal immigration and all that stuff. And I thought, geez, what if we're the immigrants and we have coyotes who kidnap our people and wipe their memories, which was then you get up for the coyote. And at some point it said, gosh, this could be a big two-parter and we could give Janeway a romance. So part of the impetus with this was, I don't think it's a classic Star Trek theme episode about, you know, immigration and illegal immigration, because you've got the memory wiping, which kind of negates that. But
right.
But that was an impetus to it. And the other kind of cute thing here is we haven't said much about Jaffin and the fact that whether you believed, you were talking about how fast she fell for him.
Yeah.
I was fine with it. I mean, I was kind of, I felt a little burned by Fairhaven and all that. But I always thought the thing she had with, and I've gone blank on him, the Imperium, the commander of the ship was inspecting them. Yeah, Kashyyyk. I always thought that came out of nowhere. Maybe it just popped out of the screen and wasn't totally intended. I mean, they kind of played with it a little bit, but that always seemed more organic than some of the other things. But I thought, let me ask this real quick, take a poll. Did you guys think that their romance, whether or not you thought it was fast, even for a two-parter? Wow, that was fast for a two-parter. Did you think that worked as a mutual attraction magnet going on there?
No, I it worked for me. I guess maybe because I've been in fast relationships. I don't know.
Oh, well okay. Then. Okay.
I think it worked fine. I don't think it, the way that it was presented, I don't know if it was sustainable, but I think that it seemed believable enough, especially knowing
in
that
the moment
she had found herself in a situation where she was able to let all the pressure of the past 7 years go. And there were obviously things that she was longing for that she was keeping suppressed. And so it made sense in that respect. But you do have to think about what's going on a little bit. Otherwise, it can seem odd.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I meant all that, if all that was going to happen and there was some ripe guy, or she's the ripe for something like that to happen, given all that, is that I'm not saying I opposed it. I thought it worked. And the only reason I brought this up was because another little bit here about the production is that they decided to give her a romance. And she got excited. Kate got excited about it. And she wanted to come in. And actually, as they cast for that part, she came in and read with everybody as they came in. So the producers were seeing a chemistry, if you know, as part of their decision-making process and their casting. So,
and in a sense, it's almost like they're on vacation. The crew, they've gone somewhere, they're on vacation. And if you look at the star dates for this episode, it seems that they were there about 3 weeks.
Okay.
So it's not like they met and 2 days later, this happens and he asks her to move in.
Right.
It does seem that it's about 3 weeks, which is fast, but not unbelievable.
Three units a day. Yeah. Anyway, I only got off on that tangent because I thought it was interesting that part of that was the luxury of this, again, this being a two-parter. So they had more money to spend. They could amortize money for sets and guest cast, and they could afford to make all those unique costumes and build the sets and do all those matte paintings for the exteriors that were gorgeous. We haven't talked about that. But anyway, and something like having the lead come in to read for a major guest role is something they would rarely have done. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking for whether it was a payoff. And I thought it wasn't revolutionary in my mind, but like if they'd gone on for 5 more years, gosh, we got to figure out a way to get him back on the show. I don't know if it was that level, but it worked here for the part of the story, I thought.
Yeah. Definitely. I think it reveals a lot about where she is. Certainly, as we've already said, you know, this kind of sense of that she's compromising an element of herself because of the situation that she's in. So I think the fact that it's so quick really reflects how much that's actually deeply bothering her on some level, even if she's not even aware of it. I think that really reflects that. I would have liked to have seen him be a bit more interesting, though. I think he was a bit one-dimensional as a character.
Well, maybe, but we don't see enough of him. We have no idea what he's outside of those scenes, which is one of the problems with this story. For me, there's a bunch of stuff going on, but like I said, they're supposed to be there for about 3 weeks. There's so much more stuff going on that there's no way they can tell us about on screen. And so it just leaves me with the feeling that the story is just meandering and I don't really understand the point. Now, Larry's explanation is very good from a logistical standpoint to explain the purpose of the story and what the writers were thinking. That all makes sense. Bruce, do you have any thoughts? Was it meandering for you or did it work for you? Was it focused?
I mean, I enjoyed it, but I really don't know what the point was. And I don't say that meaning I don't like it and it wasn't a good Star Trek story. I enjoyed it, but it's nothing where I walk away and say, okay, the meaning behind the story was, I don't know. It just,
like, if they put this out on Blu-ray, like they've done for some other two-parters, would you run out and buy it? Like, oh, I've got to have the standalone Blu-ray for this one.
No. And it didn't even feel to me like, I didn't even realize it came out in February, which is sweeps. And I mean, that makes sense, but it's not like it's some like, ooh, this is what we all been waiting for, people. This is going to be a good one.
We've been saving this one up for sweeps, right?
Yeah. It felt more like a episode. It felt like it was supposed to be one episode that, well, they had a little too much to fit it into the hour and, but not enough to maybe go 2 hours. But they decided to just go ahead and make it two. Does that ever happen?
Which is kind of what they did. That's apparently what he was saying without a lot of detail behind that.
And yet they still cut the scene with B'Elanna and Harry.
Right, they did wind up with... there were a couple of other little snippets, scenes, mainly in part two. Part one was, I couldn't find anything, you know, just having a script and watching it. That's all I'm doing, is having a final draft with all the change pages in it. And part one was pretty compact. Part two lost that scene in a couple of little transitions. When B'Elanna first comes on the bridge in the middle of the action happening, Neelix does look at her kind of like cursing at Chekhov after he's had the SETI eel taken out, or after he's been healed in motion picture. Anytime somebody's been out of commission, they walk back on the bridge for the first time, everybody kind of looks like, "Are you okay? Yes, I'm fine, Captain." Okay. There's a moment of that in Neelix looking at B'Elanna just for a second. "B'Elanna, I thought you could use a hand. You know, is it all right?" And the doctor says, "I certify her medically fit for action," or something. So there's a little moment there and just a couple. Oh, there was one. There was a little bit longer scene that I can see when Janeway tells Jaffin, or tries to tell him the truth. There's a little bit more moment of her evading, trying to, you know, "Oh no, I'm from the next valley," kind of moment, you know.
I'm from a town called Earth.
I'm in
the next valley.
We come from the. We are hill people. We come from the village.
We are hill people.
It worked in 15 other shows and series in the original series. It's just where the scene where it opens with he just kind of, it just cuts to him saying, "Am I hearing you correctly? You're helping him? He abducted one of your workers. He's a member of this crew. And you're his cap." That scene, it really started off with her trying to put him off more. "I called the plant. They said you left hours ago. Are you monitoring my movements now? I was worried." "Don't be. I'm fine." And she comes in with his coveralls. "Where are you going with those?" "I ran into Havika. He lives on level 6. He tore a sleeve. I told him you wouldn't mind." And he looks at her and he goes, "Tell me what's going on." So she tried to like lie. She was going to run off with coveralls for Chakotay. And because he had said when she sees Chakotay, or he sees her and he's messed up, and he says, "I need a change of clothes." "Why?" "I'm going back to the power plant." And she says, "You'll need more than a change of clothes." And then it cuts to him that you see when he does the dermal regenerator disguise. So there was a moment there of, so if they're looking for trims to for to cut, they did that. Other than that, the scene I told you was
save time, Larry, because that was basically later it. They didn't have to shoot the scene of Chakotay wearing the coveralls.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That would have exceeded the budget right there.
Hey guys, I know it's two-parter, but let's not get ridiculous.
We have no money for coveralls. You've got to cut that.
We spent it all on those gorgeous matte paintings. Yeah. Right. Which were awesome. I mean,
they were.
It's like, we're sitting here talking about, oh, writing and characters. No, it was a sweep show because of matte paintings. Come on. Oh, look, it's a sweep show. Oh, okay. Alien City. Ooh, ah. You couldn't tell?
I'm just
character
wondering.
Character.
What? Watching this episode, and this time I was watching it on Netflix, and looking at the matte paintings, I was imagining if they released this on Blu-ray, what would those look like? Yes.
They probably have to be I don't know, but they probably have to be retooled. It seemed to me like the res that they would do those at was really soft. Like, just for us to get them for printing in the magazine back in the day, you'd want 300 DPI, and you could only go so far with them, like half page.
Right.
So, right. And, of course, they're all 4:3. Well, the whole show's 4:3, but... yeah.
It's a good thing they made the matte paintings the same.
Yeah, well, the original matte paintings may have been...
Probably.
16:9, right.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
4:3.
So they could pan on them, you know. The paintings, like the old original ones that they did for like Next Gen or widescreen.
But if they did that today, they would pan by them really quickly. So you could barely see what was going on.
Right. It was foot pan blur.
So, Kay, do you have any thoughts on the point of the episode? And then I'll tell you guys what I came up with.
But yeah, absolutely.
I'm not sure whether it's about the point of the episode, but what I see in the episode is obviously we see like this deep discontent that Janeway's got. We also kind of see, I think, for some of the characters, we see how much they've changed from the start of the show. I really like seeing, obviously we've already talked about Tom, but I really like seeing how much Harry's grown. You know, he's left on the ship there with the Doctor, and he just seems like that's a situation where in season one we wouldn't have seen him cope with that whatsoever. He's always looking to somebody above him for guidance, and I just really like to see that he's now capable of really handling that sort of a situation and how much more mature he is. So I think for me it's more about seeing how these characters have changed as a result of what's happened in the show.
But he still can't out-argue a hologram for a command. It's like, damn, you'd think if I was the only solid, that's DS9. I'm the only, what's the Voyager term?
I don't know.
I'm the only monocle.
Flesh and blood.
Yeah.
I'm the only flesh and blood. No, that's an episode. I'm the only real organic being on the damn ship, and I still can't get command. Okay.
Yeah.
I think it would have been funny if Harry would have put on a red uniform and went up to the Doctor and said, okay, now who's in command?
Yeah.
But do it secretly. Come in sick bay or come on the bridge, walk up behind him, tap him on the shoulder, wait for him to turn around, and then say it. Like, don't walk in and flaunt it.
Right.
Be very passive-aggressive about it.
Yeah.
And just like the
make
uniform.
Sure that you put 4 pips on, because the ECH is not wearing 4 pips in this episode.
No. No, well,
I didn't notice. Right. Is he blank or is he just under?
He's just wearing as usual, I guess. Are there no pips?
There are none. Yeah, which is interesting because when he first is the ECH in Tinker Tenor Doctor Spy, they pop out, don't they? Boop, boop.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, that was one of the things
budget for that.
that was in Janeway's memo when she said, like, yes, you may continue tinkering with this, but no pips.
Yeah.
See?
And no coveralls.
No coveralls.
But it also allowed he and Harry to have that little moment, because if he was wearing 4 pips, there's no argument. I mean, hologram or not, he would be.
Yeah.
Right? Wouldn't you say? Or also, it's like there would be no. The pips were his fantasy. So if she actually allowed him to have them on there, then that would be it would be like, you're my guy. You're my representative when we need to have somebody there, so Kim couldn't have argued with him and you could have had that scene.
I think
that's my headcanon.
I think
anyway,
I think if she'd have let him have the pips, she probably would have never got her shit back.
Yeah, well,
that would have been
probably.
It then. He'd have been like, nope, I'm in charge.
I'm just thinking coveralls would work really well on DS9 because you have the colored tunics underneath, so then you could have the black coveralls and you could still see what division you're in.
Yeah, they would look cool actually.
As long as you can have like Miles sleeve roll up moments. It's like no one else ever tried to actually roll up sleeves in Star Trek.
I think in this case he would have to roll up the pants legs of the coveralls.
The what legs? The pants legs. Yes.
The trouser legs.
All right.
Trouser the legs. Trouser. Well, yeah.
Good point. Yes. I think that was on the other side of the room.
Yes.
Where we were talking about pants. Yes. And the difference in meaning between the UK and Japan and the US. All right. What I came up with this is it's sort of similar to what you were saying, Kay, in the, how the characters evolve together. And when I say the point of the episode, I don't mean the point in terms of a social message or anything like that, because I think what Larry was talking about with immigration is probably where that was headed. But just in terms of the characters and it being a Star Trek story, it did highlight for me how the Voyager crew has become a family over 7 years in the Delta Quadrant and how they care for one another and how they rely on one another. Because the way that Tom approaches B'Elanna, or the way that Tuvok is remembering and he's trying to tell Janeway or tell others, Seven, what's going on, and the way that Harry and Chakotay are working to rescue them, just shows the bond that they have, and even the subconscious, especially the Tom and B'Elanna thing, this subconscious feeling that they have for one another, that maybe their memory's been altered and they don't remember who they are, and the two of them don't remember they're married, but it's there on a certain level, and you couldn't have that earlier in the series. So I took that from it, although it still doesn't help the feeling that I have that the story was just sort of meandering. And
yeah,
every time I watch it, I kind of get to the end and feel like, okay, well, that was an episode, and then go to the next thing, because it just doesn't stick with me. You know, there are those stories that stick with you and you want to watch them over and over again. And then in between viewings, you think about those stories and all the nuances of the message. And I just didn't get that from this.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, I didn't think about, I didn't think about forced labor or immigration or anything when I watched the show originally. It was just a theme piece. It was just to read Ken talking about, illegal immigration and coyotes rounding people up. And then they give it a sci-fi layer on top of that. I mean, it struck me more as more like a springboard than a good solid Star Trek, you know, theme show, like where Distant Origin is kind of a commentary on science versus religion and all that. Yeah, and it kind of resonates in a science fiction way for Voyager. This one just seemed like a big sprawling adventure and if that was the impetus to make some commentary on forced labor or immigrant labor or something, I don't think that was even, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but that doesn't even come across to me. When at the end, if there's anything, it's just, that was an interesting sci-fi plot device. And I guess where they think they expand the show into 2 hours and what was supposed to take up the time is talking about the family moments and letting everybody have their moment.
Yeah.
You know, not just having it be a Janeway vehicle and everybody else gets like a 2 second scene. They actually tried to give everybody a mini arc and let them run with that and play, and including the guys back on the ship who haven't been changed, and let them have some moments.
Mentioning the end reminds me, the other thing I took away on the third viewing yesterday is that 31 minutes into the second episode, that's when we get the discussion with the doctor, Cadine, who's altering people's memories and sending them into labor. And the other person calls him out on it. And he says that he's not doing anything wrong. He's helping them live happier, more productive lives. That is the interesting concept, the interesting science fiction concept in this episode that should have been threaded through the entire story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it would have been a much, much stronger story about people's role in society and jobs and happiness and the ethics of what the doctor is doing. Because obviously we wouldn't be altering someone's memories in this way, but we do use, especially in the United States, we do use a lot of mind-altering medications for people who are depressed. In some cases, absolutely necessary. In other cases, probably not the best solution to their problem, but they are prescribed anyway, and they do affect people's lives and how they view their lives. And that could have been addressed in something like what's going on here with this doctor.
Or was he so indoctrinated into his culture that he's made himself believe that that's the ethical case for it?
Oh, sure.
Whether he sincerely believes that, or whether he's so far gone that he can spout that and he's inculcated in that.
But the mere fact that this ethical quandary is taking place with all of this storyline, it never comes up until 31 minutes into the second episode.
It's a wasted,
When you get to that point, you're like, what were the writers thinking all the way up to this point that it never occurred to them? Even if they came up with the idea as they were getting near the end of the second, then go back and revise it and weave that through somehow. Mm-hmm. It would have made the story work much better for me. And I guess that's my final thought. So
it's like the Borg baby.
For you guys.
It's like the Borg baby, Chris.
It's the Borg baby. Yeah. So I guess that's my final thought on the episode. So Kay, what's your final thought?
Yeah, I agree with you. I definitely think you're right there. I feel like it needed something more, and I think you've probably hit on what it was, that this moral quandary is really what the episode should be all about, and yet it isn't quite. And it's really nice to have all the character stuff. And I think that is the thing that a lot of people don't acknowledge is what Voyager is really strong at. And I think having all of that in there is great. And at this point in the show, it's really great to see that and feel like we're getting, as you said, Larry, you know, a little bit of screen time and a little bit of an arc for all the characters in this quite, you know, drawn out story, that they all get their time. But I feel like it needed that extra element to be played out more in it. And I think if they'd done that, it could have been a really great episode rather than just quite a good episode, which is what it is. So that's probably my final thought.
Yeah, I agree with both of you on that. And so I'm not going to expand too much on that, except when you mentioned, Chris, about what is it that you remember if you leave the episode? There isn't a whole lot there that I think it's going to stick with me, except for maybe two things. And I'm just going to be totally honest with you. It's like when I walk away from that episode, the things I'm going to remember are, one, the relationship between Tom and B'Elanna. I think that episode really was strong in stating that they are meant for each other, because even though they don't remember each other, they were still attracted to each other and there was still a chemistry there. And their last scene together, when they're back together and they're in their quarters and he's watching cartoons and she comes over and kisses him, he's like, what's that for? And she's like, you know, because you were still there and you still cared about me, even though you didn't know who I was. And then she punches him and he's like, and what's that for? And she's like, that's for flirting with, you know, when he was working there. So to me, that just spoke a lot about their relationship. And then the other thing about this episode that I'll remember is, oh, it was great to see Don Most, who played Ralph Mouth in Happy Days.
I was
Days.
Just...
right, Larry?
I was going to point that out in a couple of pointers, but yeah. Yes. So Donnie Most can say, well, take that, Anson, you directed, but I was on camera, ha ha. Not this episode, but Anson directed on some others on DS9 Voyager.
Yeah.
Do you have a final thought, Larry?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've kind of pretty much said that. I mean, this is one that I don't know if I just watched this one. I just love the Colonel Wilma Deering. I'd never thought of that before. That shade of blue, turquoisey, blue-green is, second season. I hadn't thought about this in a long time. This was obviously a show they put a lot of time and energy and production value into, and it's, you know, I'm kidding, but the matte paintings and some of the scope, they shot this on the lot. Oh, I did want to say they even shot the exteriors are on the lot, across the lot. And one of the cool things is, aside from some of the obvious kind of New York street redress things they did for the outdoor scenes, the whole sequence with Chakotay on the stairwell, that stairwell, it's got matte paintings all around it to give all that industrial kind of almost 50s looking. In fact, the art department got Tim Merles and Jeff Mandel said they were going for a Stalinist Soviet Russia kind of era with the interiors of the power plant, you know, very 50s clunky, you know, grimy tetraon radiation spewing thing. But the exterior where you get the close-ups, but then also the pullback when Chakotay's on the stairs and the whole cliffhanger moment is him jumping off. They've matted in a lot of industrial stuff around it, but the actual stairwell and that immediate piece, that is the backside of the big blue sky backing
that a lot of fans know very well is where they flood the B tank and they did the Bird of Prey scene filming in Star Trek IV. It's a landmark on the Paramount lot, and it's usually a parking lot. In the old days, they would do like miniature sea battles in there and but movies occasionally.
Those stairs are on the back side of that.
So whenever we do, whenever I have a friend at the lot or whenever we take, do our big LA to Vegas tour, that's one of the things we can point to. And it's one of those things you go, oh yeah, because that corrugated metal that's up behind the zigzaggy stairwell, it's all exposed. That's all exactly the way it is, which is, you know, which is a fun thing. So if you ever find yourself on the lot, everybody, walk behind, after you go, there's the blue sky where they crashed the Bird of Prey and did the whale scene. Walk around behind that on your way over to New York Street, which you'll see a lot of other locations, and then but turn around and look at the backside of the backing, and that's Chakotay's Corin stairs at the Central Power Plant. Yeah. One other cool thing, and here's what I was getting refreshed. Jeff Mandel did tell me this. So inside the power plant, there's a lot of circuit board looking, you know, they did all these, they spent 3 weeks on that set, which they could do for three, so they spent a lot of money on that thing. Mm. And Jeff said that he actually, as an homage to the original series, you know, the big circuit board in engineering, in Scotty's engineering, that wound up being on the wall and then another one at the little triangle station. Mm-hmm. Anyway, those circuits, Jeff got a picture of that dead on, traced those unique angles, and then played with it, modified it, did overlays. But that is the element core that he played with to expand out on for all the alien core and circuitry gibberish that's all over the control panels. So back at the very bottom of that, art-wise, there's a little homage to Scotty's engineering in there, just for fun.
Interesting. The one other homage to Scotty that I felt in this episode was B'Elanna in the bar, because it seemed like she wanted to be left alone with her journals and just read like Scotty would.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, and one more little casting thing. So Umali, the waitress, is Iona Morris, who is Phil Morris's sister. And not only, you know, Phil Morris was the alien astronaut and a couple of other things.
He played in Voyager. Klingon and Jim Hadar as
yes,
well.
Yes, but both Alona and, Iona and Phil are Greg Morris's kids, right, who was on, best known for the original Mission Impossible, next door to the original series. But Iona and Phil were both among the little kids in Miri. Mm-hmm. All the onlys in Miri were people like Grace Lee's kids and Shatner's daughters and some of the producers and writers and crew people's kids were all the kids in there.
Oh, that's cool.
So the Umali in this is, you know, there were only two African-American kids in that scene. And Phil is the one with, I think, the Army helmet. But anyway, she's wearing pink. So there's a cute little throwback, throwaway bit for you.
And Umali was also sporting the popular Delta Quadrant feather headgear, which reminded me of Liddell Wren from Ex Post Facto in season
one.
The feathers around the head.
Yeah.
I even went to look at photos of both to make sure they weren't the same species. Because they look so similar.
And, oh my God, I forgot the people. But remember, the Nazi, we blotted it from our memories episode where B'Elanna was the memory
Killing
central
Game.
Character. Yes. No, not Killing Game. It was a 1 hour standalone. Remember? Was it just called Remember?
Oh, right. Yes. Remember.
Oh,
yes.
That's Remember, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, she had feathery stuff too. Just furthering your meme, Chris. I'm just furthering.
Yes. I remember that.
I'm feathering your meme is what I'm.
You're
also
feathering my meme. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So, time to wrap up. So, Bruce, what is your rating for this episode?
Well, wow, this is really tough because I do like the episode, but I also feel like it's pretty weak and empty in a lot of areas. It's not something I'm going to remember. And when I went to go watch it, I was like, I don't really remember that much about this episode. And then I realized, oh, it's two parts. I didn't even remember that. But
full of sound and fury signifying that.
But I enjoyed it. I mean, I did like it, and I did like a lot of the character moments and seeing the doctor on the bridge and with Harry and I even liked the moment with Neelix and B'Elanna when he took her to her quarters to try to get her memories back. It was just little moments like that in there. So I would say that if there's 7 days in the week, I would give Chakotay maybe 4 change of clothes.
Excellent. How about you, Kay?
Yeah, I do enjoy this episode for the character stuff, because I do love all of the character stuff in Voyager. But as we've already said, it is sort of, it's lacking a bit of something, really. So I think I'm going to probably give it about 6 alien parasites out of 10.
So, Larry, what's your rating on this one?
I'm a little saddened because I watched this and I think it had all the potential to be something more. And I was even sadder now when I realized they had this inkling of having some kind of an immigration, illegal immigration, even maybe overtures of like forced labor camp, not, I don't know about Nazi level, you know, your labor sets you free kind of ridiculous inversion. But the fact, and that they named the acquirer of the immigrant labor a coyote of unaware immigrants, and it just seems like maybe it suffered from a lot of good intentions, both thematically and then for the characters worked more than a great Star Trek theme to it. But it just again, it just seems like I think it suffered from the dash to the finish line. From any angle that you're looking at emotionally for everybody involved, and not knocking anybody, but I'm just from the writers and producers side and the crew. I mean, people couldn't help being where they were. So it's like Bruce said, it's like he even forgot it was a two-parter. The fact this was a sweep show, I think it was fun to watch it when it went by, or it's fun to sit down and watch it now, but it doesn't add anything really new. The other thing I thought was funny was, poor Baxiel. It's like Neelix's shuttle. It's there. It's like no one ever remembered, like once every 2 or 3 years go by and people go, oh wait, Neelix has a shuttle in this cargo bay. The amazing shrinking right. shuttle in our amazing, you know, tiny little ship's tiny little shuttle bay that can hold suddenly 2 or 3 shuttles in it all of a sudden. Plus the Delta Flyer, plus yeah. Neelix's incredible shrinking shuttle. I mean, it wasn't even until 6th season that it got a name. So like a year before this, they got a name, the Baxiel. So this one is like, wait, I've got a shuttle. I can be a combat pilot again. Oh, okay. Which kind of sets up Homestead, right? Coming up here in a few episodes as they're coming along. So I don't know. To me, it's more like missed opportunities. It just, they were trying this big, expansive show and some of the pieces expanded and they're filling up the space and some of them didn't quite get there. And I don't think it's from lack of trying or lack of time or anything. So I don't know. I would say I would give it 7 Leola roots, I guess.
As Leola root bark tea, of course.
Yes. 6.5.
For this one.
6.5.
Six and a half.
Yeah. Right. Oh, one more quick note. Roxanne Dawson directed part 2.
That's right. All right. Well, I've said pretty much everything I have to say about this one. I agree with you guys. It's okay to watch, but it doesn't really stick with me. So I'm going to give it 4 cases of dysphoria syndrome. All right. So before we go, Kay, tell everyone where they can find you around the network and around the interwebs.
Well, you can find me on Trek FM's Voyager podcast, To the Journey, over there with my co-host Zach and Suzanne. You can also find me in the Babel Conference, always chatting away to people in there. And if you want to look me up on Twitter, my handle is Choco Weeble.
Choco Weeble. Yeah. Interesting one. Very good. And Bruce, where can people find you?
I wish I had an interesting handle. I don't like my handle, but it's too late to change it because everybody knows it. But I'm on Twitter at Admiral_Rex. There's a long story behind that, which I'm not going to get into, but it's Admiral_Rex. And then you can find me here on the network on Literary Treks with Dan Gunther, where we're talking about the Star Trek books and comics. And you can find me on the Star Wars Report talking about, of all things, Star Wars. And you can check that podcast out. And, of course, you can find me in the Babel Conference, too.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Well, Larry, it was fun talking about workforce. When we went into it, I wasn't sure what all the points were going to be and, of course, how much background info you had. But I really appreciate those scenes that you pulled out of the original script there.
Oh, sure. Lost to history.
Lost to history. That's true. But things that are not lost to history are shows we've been talking about here on the network over the past week. So here's a quick look at some of those.
Previously on Trek.fm, To the Journey!
So his whittling skills are so advanced that he can whittle wood into leather.
Into vegan leather, yes.
He is now Rumpelstiltskin. He is the Rumpelstiltskin of the Marquee.
Warp 5.
You think they start to like each other, and then it's more like a father-daughter kind of relationship, and then he basically becomes 50 First Dates, and she falls in love with him.
So, that's great. That is true.
The 602 Club.
Yeah, I mean, Christopher Lee, that's inspired to have him in that role. It really is such a good bit of casting to have him there.
Primitive Culture. A look at history and culture through Star Trek.
The key thing with Jetrelli is all of these elements are exactly the same thing as the events in real life. You know, the Metron Cascade is the bomb. Rhinax is Nagasaki or Hiroshima. You know, the poisoning is analogous to radiation poisoning and all these different things. And the parallels are enormously overt with Jetrell straight away.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or in the desktop iTunes application to get the latest episode as soon as it's published. It'll be pushed right out to you. And if you have a moment, please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered there as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps, and you can also stream and download the MP3 from our website or grab the RSS link. Now, if you'd like to share your thoughts on today's show, I'd love to hear from you. There are many ways for you to do that. The best place is to join in the larger conversation over in the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right on up. And if you'd like to send me an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and select the Ready Room, and that'll come right over to me. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our username there is TrekFM. And on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And lastly, if you'd like to send me a voicemail, you can do that just using your tablet, phone, or computer by going to speakpipe.com. That's the word speak, S-P-E-A-K, pipe.com. And you can record using the mic on your device and upload it to me as an MP3. And I'd love to hear from you that way as well. So Larry, speaking of contact and things coming up, where can people find you if they want to ask you questions, and where can they find you in person if they want to see you somewhere?
Those are big ifs, Chris. But if so, no, I'm always at LarryNemechek.com, and that is kind of the umbrella for theconofwrath.com, which is our documentary, which we're actually starting to finally edit on a big sample chunk right now. And Portal47.net, which is where, if you enjoy the kind of dot connecting we were doing that I was doing tonight, that's what we do every with Star Trek past, present, and future, like a mini-con all year long for no savvy fans gone before at portal47.net. I'm very proud of the way that's evolving. But a couple more things coming up this summer, hopefully, that I can't talk about now, but I will be coming up at SoonerCon back home in Oklahoma City the end of June, and San Diego Comic-Con, and Star Trek Las Vegas, and our one-day tour this year. This is the off year for the big tour that I do with Geek Nation Tours, the Star Trek Film Site Tour. But we are doing the one-day Valley of Fire tour the day before Vegas. And then after that, I'm going to be on another library tour around Greater Detroit in middle of August. And then at a fun little thing called Sputnik Fest in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. And back at Salt Lake Comic-Con in September. So that's all down the pike. And who knows, maybe some more things thrown in there, and somewhere along the way we should have a good chunk of the Conorath to maybe show as a sneak peek.
Looks like you're trying to compete with Jeffrey Combs, Larry.
He is everywhere.
Chris, you know I could never, ever compete with Jeff Combs.
You are everywhere. All right, so that's a lot of places.
Oh, and at Larry, you know, the easiest may just be at Larry Nemechek on Twitter and Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook. And Instagram. And
all
Instagram.
Right, good. And Instagram. That's right. Yes, yes. I've got to see those pictures of that you're going to Photoshop yourself into with Rick Berman, which we talked about on the other side of the room.
The way on the other side of the room.
That's right. All right, very good. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook and pretty much everywhere in social media. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me with Matthew Rushing doing The Orb. That's our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. And you can also find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. I'd like to take a moment and thank my associate producers here on The Ready Room, Renee Roberts, Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, Kay Elizabeth Shaw, who you saw today or you heard today, Tim Robertson, and David Shuford. Thank you guys so much for helping me keep The Ready Room going. And if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming out each week, just like Renee, Zachary, Sam, Kay, Tim, and David do, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. We could use your help to keep everything going. It does cost quite a bit of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each day of the week and each week and each month, depending on the show. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope that you will join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And thank you so much to everyone who is contributing there right now. I really, really appreciate it. Well, Larry, this was a really interesting discussion today, not only about workforce, but about Star Trek Discovery in the news segment. So thanks for jumping on mic with me. And we're a little bit delayed from the release of the trailer. We can't do our immediately jump on mic anymore like we used to, but I'm glad you set aside some time for me anyway.
Hey, Chris, it's always a pleasure, and I don't know who else I'd rather jump on mic with more than you.
Well, thank you.
But you know what, Chris? It's time to stick a Big Dipper handle in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Recording.
Blue workforce pants. All right.
Pajamas and onesies, that's what I have to say. We have too much hilarity about pants, because pants in the UK means underpants. So.
Yeah, same in Japanese as well.
Yeah.
Pantsu means underwear, and zubon means pants, so.
So I guess pants suit is a wholly different concept.
That would be good.
Yeah, we call it a trousers.
Hillary Clinton was wearing her pantsu suit. That would be very amusing.
Which in the US are long johns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, we call it a trouser suit.
Right.
So.
Trouser suit.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, if you say pantsuit, we know what it means, because, you know.
Because, yeah.
We get a lot of American TV. It's fine. We understand. It's so funny.
Already been corrupted.
Every time this comes up onto The Journey, I always make Zach and Suzanne laugh with half the stuff I say. And anytime they say something like that, I understand it, because we just, yeah. We used to American stuff because all the TV things.